This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else. Hello and welcome to Buzz. I'm your fill-in host, Derek Howard. Now, normally I can be found at Comic Book Noise, which can be found at comicbooknoise.com, and is a part of the Deliberate Noise Network, just like Marvel Noise is. For more details, please go to deliberatenoise.com. If you'd like to send feedback to me, you can email me. My email address is Derek, that's D-E-R-E-K, at comicbooknoise.com. Or if you would like to send feedback to either Comic Book Noise or Marvel Noise or pretty much any shows in the Deliberate Noise Network, you can call the audio comment line at 734-331-0772. You can also follow me on... Well, you can follow Comic Book Noise. You can see I'm trying to tailor my intro to another show's intro, and it's a lot more difficult than I thought. Anyway, you can follow me on Twitter or Facebook as Derek Coward, or on Instagram as Comic Book Noise. I don't know David's – well, I do know David's information, but I don't know if I should be giving it out, so I'm not going to. Anyway, David asked me to fill in real quick, so that is what I am going to do. Now, later on, there's going to be Steve. I believe he's going to have his recent reads. Yeah, there's a thing I'm glad I didn't mess up. Andrew, Kevin, and Steve are going to cover the year 2000 crossover, the Nefaria Protocols between the Avengers and Thunderbolts. I don't think I've read that, so this will be new to me as well. Anyway, however, before I turn it over to them, I do want to talk a little bit, because normally I talk very little on Marvel Noise. I just introduce it, say, hey, this is going to happen, and then I take off. And that's normally because I know that most of the Marvel Noise listening audience does not like when I guest host, but I'm going to be nice and just say David asked me to, so he knows what he's doing. Anyway, recently I finished reading the Fantastic Four by Jonathan Hickman, Omnibus Volume Number 2. And I really enjoyed the first half, you know, the Volume 1. But now that I've read the whole thing, and, you know, I'm probably going to do something I very rarely do, which is I'm probably going to read both of these Omnibi again, back to back, because I read the first one, and then months later I read the second one. Well, I got the first one when it came out, and then I had to wait what I think was several months, but it could have been like almost a year, I'm not even sure now, for the second one to come out. And man, it's some really good storytelling. There's a lot of like big concepts that were being explored, you know. And the fact of what I liked is it all started off with the fact that Reed Richards wanted to do more with the Fantastic Four. You know, he wanted to do more than just, you know, have these random adventures and, you know, because they're not really crime fighters, but, you know, fighting supervillains and fighting extraterrestrial or interdimensional threats are all well and good, but it doesn't really give, you know, the team the opportunity to change the world. Even though, let's face it, they're the Fantastic Four, and when they debuted in real life, they changed comic books. Yeah, just ask Marvel Comics where they would have been if Stan Lee had decided, I really don't feel like writing comic books anymore. Yeah, think about that for a second. But, you know, Jonathan Hickman took a look at what they call the Council of Reeds, where all these different Reed Richards from all these different realities pretty much met up to fix everything, you know. This is really good. Just a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of stuff that was also going on between the Kree and the Inhumans. And I think that's probably the main reason why I want to reread it, is because now I can also take a look at, because I have Marvel Unlimited now, I can take a look at other things that are going on that led up to this thing between the Kree and the Inhumans, including War of Kings, which I read a couple of issues of War of Kings, but I never actually finished it. So I'm going to check that out. But I've just really enjoyed it. If you haven't read these books, I really suggest searching them out, you know, trying to find them. I don't know how many of the issues are on Marvel Unlimited, because I'm finding that although it says Marvel Unlimited, there's some things that are just not on there. You know, if you don't believe me, just go look for Alpha Flight, you know, the original, it was a 1982 series. So anyway, I've rambled for way past long enough. Here's Steve.
Hey heroes, Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Andrew the LA Rabbit and Whirlwind X Kevin.
Barely here, boys. Barely holding on to that thin ray of hope. It is Marvel Noise.
Well, I know those incursions are coming fast and furious now, but whew!
We've scraped ourselves up off the tarmac to talk about just some of the books we've been reading lately in the Marvel Universe. What is bigger than the Spider-Verse that's just been wrapping up, that Dan Slott has been penned along with various other creators, a massive amount, actually. The last issue just came out today as we're recording, which is about a half a week ago by the time this episode airs, and the finale was very satisfying, and I thought the whole event was really entertaining, including all of the tie-ins, even the tie-ins that I thought weren't, you know, the most interesting. When added to the entire tapestry, I felt like it was fun to have that extra information in there, whether it was my favorite tale of one of the alternate spider people or not or whatever. And the incidents that happened in some of the tie-ins, like in the Spider-Man 2099 and in the Scarlet Spider titles and things, I thought really, you know, made sense to carrying the story along. And in Spider-Woman, and I felt like it was just a really cohesively put together old style event where the tie-ins really mattered, but you were already reading all the books kind of thing, other than Spider-Woman being the only new one added to the mix. But I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, I had two great gripes about the footnotes, but you know, it usually worked out. There's this one time I'm like, that seems like a big plot development that happened in another book.
Yeah, I mean, it really was an event that encompassed the entire Spidey-verse, so I think it's fair to, you know, stretch the story out into everything, because all the characters really were involved, and having the cast whittled down to, you know, a few favorites and some others that kind of you're surprised to see standing amongst the last bunch of spiders as they make their final assault. I just thought it was neat. And I always liked the whole spider totem, JMS era, Ezekiel spider stuff. I like that little touch of the mystical and that, you know, there was a little cosmic totem angle there. And the fact that they've revisited this whole, you know, totem eating character, Moreland, and then added his whole family was really creepy and seemed like a really unsurmountable type of foe. There's still a bunch of unanswered questions as I have wrapped up the last issue, but I'm hoping that in some of the epilogues we'll get some more fallout before the Secret Wars hits and everything changes again.
I'm kind of with you, Steve. I enjoyed the... That had just kind of finished up right when I got back into Spider-Man. And I picked them up all in back issues. I got back in buying them CD-ROMs that had all the Amazing Spider-Mans on it.
Sure.
Picked them up. And I thought it... I mean, I don't know month to month if it worked, but reading them, you know, just buying like 8 or 10 issues and reading them, they felt pretty satisfying at the time. And I... And while I'm falling behind, I did scoop up the recent issue. Well, not that recent, but the Spider-Ham one I had to go of that guy.
Spider-Ham has a big moment at the end, which is pretty interesting. But, yeah, I mean, they used every iteration of Spider-Man, as I'm sure you've heard elsewhere on the web and in other podcasts and stuff, but even the newspaper and, you know, comic strip and cartoon versions. And it was just such a celebration of all things Spider-Man at a time where, again, Marvel is teasing that everything might change. So it was fun to really, let's take this to the total extreme where, again, these genies can't be put back in the bottle, and really fun.
1960s Spider-Man stuff always cracks me up because they, like, go to that world where everything's, like... They're like, hey, how come that building only has 3 windows and stuff like that? And I'm like, it's so true.
And he's like, what's with all the webs? Because he didn't, because the 60s Spider-Man didn't have webs on the torso part of his costume, just the gloves and mask. Really fun. And the collected editions, I think whatever oversized omnibus they make out of this, I think is going to read really fun and be a great hunk of spider lore for your bookshelf.
And that Spider-Gwen is heating up the world. Even my wife was like, "What jumped on Comixology to get the issue," or when she was curious. And it seems to be, I don't know, I think it's part of the wave of current redesigns of lady superheroes to sort of still make them attractive, but not so much the big cleavage and all that. But that design and image and everything is everywhere. I'm really glad to see, I mean, Spider-Man's always at the top, but it's nice to see his supporting cast really making more of a splash. As you guys remember, I was a big fan of that Paul Tobin Spider-Girl series that lasted like 12 issues or something back in the day.
Yep, she was there. And so it was Mayday, Spider-Girl, and every other spider you can imagine. Again, like I said, really, really fun. You just go along for the ride, and the stakes are high, so it's not all, you know, laughs or anything, but the moments of satisfaction that you get out of it aren't necessarily humorous ones. It's more like seeing them touch upon this part of the world or that part of the world and seeing them interact. But fun stuff.
Japanese Spider-Man.
Yeah. What about you, Kev?
I've been reading some new books. One of the books that hasn't come out in, what was it, 6 months? I forget what you said, Steve. Hawkeye, when was the last issue?
Yeah, wasn't it like solicited for June, the issue that just came out?
Yeah, and there's still another one. But, you know, it's a long wait. But you get to it and you're like, oh, jeez, here we go. See if I can remember everything. But then I get into it and I'm like, this is still really, really good.
And is it still the same creative team of Fraction and Aja?
Yeah, it's still Fraction, Aja. Aja is like a superstar. At this point, I'm like, if he's grooving with like another creator on whatever book he's doing, it's like I'm there. I'm like, it's just phenomenal. Just love this stuff. And then you kind of wonder if he would get back into it. But it's like, yeah, you kind of go for a moment of like, where was that guy? But it's pretty straightforward. Like, they're trying to protect their whole apartment building from the bros. They like to say bro. Hey, bro. So that's what it takes you through their whole, like, everyone sort of comes together and they fight off the bros. Or do they? But, you know, still is awesome. Still good. Still enjoying it.
Is Kate Bishop still in it?
Not really, because he kind of, you know, he was kind of, you know how Hawkeye is.
Yeah.
Everyone just sort of leaves him and like, yeah, okay, go fend for yourself now because you were so mean to me or whatever. But he still has the people from his apartment to look out for him, and they, they have some interesting gimmicks. Like they have, you know, they're barbecuing on the roof before, so they're like throwing like all the ashes from the barbecue down onto the bros and stuff like that. Or then they have the stairwell like full of chairs and everything, so it's hard to get up. So some things come to a conclusion, but looking forward to where this is going, and then when Lemire takes over, so good stuff.
It's funny, I read the Hawkeye versus Deadpool miniseries that was 5 issues, because there was a 0 issue, and then 4 issues after that, and I actually read the last 3 Deadpool limited series is from 2014, the Hawkeye versus Deadpool being one of them, and that was written by Jerry Dugan, the regular writer of Deadpool, with art by Matteo Lali and Jacopo Camanghi, with these like really Jason Pearson like covers, but they're not Pearson, they're James Harren, who I'm not familiar with, but his stuff is really good. And this series was really entertaining, and it gave me that taste of the Hawkeye series kind of that I liked, but with another writer handling it in Dugan here. The art was really good by Lali. The characterization was really entertaining. It's like Deadpool obviously was handled very well because Dugan writes his series, but also how he wrote Clint, and Kate Bishop is in this series, right, you know, in like all the issues. It might as well have been called Hawkeye and Deadpool. And Kate Bishop and Deadpool getting along, like, to Clint's, you know, consternation is hilarious. Like, they, like, understand each other on a vibe that, you know, Clint's on the outside of, and it, like, ticks him off, which is funny. So there's these great interactions going on between the three of them. And it's not really a versus, even though versus is in the title. They're really working together. You know, so they're kind of getting in each other's way as far as their strategies and tactics and things. It does become versus a little bit later, like in the 3rd issue, because Hawkeye once again, now it's becoming really cliched, right? Hawkeye becomes compromised. So then it's Kate Bishop and Deadpool dealing with Hawkeye. The thing I really almost vehemently disliked about the series, though, is that the big bad is like a Bond villain type setup, okay? Like a structure. Really corporate-oriented, setting up this empire and, like, genetically manipulating people, you know, to their detriment and sending people experimenting on them to their death and all that stuff. And who's the mastermind, the big bad, is the Black Cat.
What?
It just seems like way too much too soon for her new I'm bad now, not good, you know, change of heart that they're done with the new Amazing Spider-Man series.
They're gonna have to sell that hard, because I'm not buying it so far.
Yeah, but everything else about the series was really cool, guys, I swear. And it was worth reading just for that. And Black Cat's still fun to look at, but her zipper was up all the way to the neck, and she was more like a big boss. She might as well have been stroking a little white cat behind a desk the whole series. It was really weird.
Yeah, I actually saw Jerry Dugan and Scott Koblish were at the Pasadena Comic and Toy Show.
Ah, cool.
And I always go out of my way to go see Scott Koblish. He I believe does the inking and some of the art for the Deadpool. He's a great guy. If you get a chance to meet him, just super friendly, been around forever. I bought a great Pace Pop Pete from him that he had done for some magazine or so. Like, he had all these beautiful pieces and they were super cheap. And it was pretty nice that he had just a ton of them sitting there, and like, you know, cause he did it for something else. So I bought a bunch of them. This was at a few cons ago, and Sergio was there, and I bought some old toys, one of them 2 toys and a comic packages. It had the old Star Wars Marvel Darth Vader,
mm-hmm.
like back when Chaykin did it,
yep.
And the figure is done with the coloring like that.
Oh, so funny. Isn't that with, like, the green highlights in it?
Yeah, they did a blue and black, so there's, like, splashes of blue on him.
Yeah, yeah.
And the helmet and the red eyes, and it's really cool. And And then you get a little rebel soldier, and then the little torture floating ball droid. So all in all, it was like a nice pickup. And other than that, for big names, Scott Shaw. Oh, Andrew Robinson was there. He did the fifth Beatle, but he also did the cover. He's doing a lot of covers lately, including for the Winter Soldier. And I did read that, the Long March.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
I don't know,
yeah.
Is that still new or is that old? I did read the trade of that.
Yeah, it was last
year. Came out, yeah, for the movie.
Okay, so I guess that doesn't count as new comics, but I read that.
Hey, it's Marvel you've been reading, that's all. That's all. That's the only criteria here.
Yeah, I've been reading some classic Marvel, too.
I'm not saying last year is not classic. Also, it's Marvel Essential number one. Now that's classic.
Kevin, before you get classic, because you mentioned Scott Koblish, the most recent of the Deadpool limited series was Deadpool's Art of War that ended 2014 and into 2015, and it was four issues. It was written by Peter David with art by Scott Koblish, and really nice art. He might have done the colors too, but I could be wrong there, but he definitely did the pencils and inks. Really nicely illustrated, and it's Deadpool enacting various, like, Act of War or Art of War lessons, you know, and he is wanting to write his own Art of War book, but no publisher will pick it up. So he's like, well, what about, like, if I take, like, this angle on it and talk about how, like, people have to deal with it being on the other side of it, or and then she's like, all right, there you go. And so he goes off to smite people with the lessons from the Art of War, and he goes back in time and hooks up with Loki back in, like, the John Buscema drawn days of Thor, and helps Loki totally take down Asgard using you know, quotes from the book throughout. And it's really silly, and then Deadpool ends up on the side of the resistance with Thor and the other Asgardians, and then they have to displace you know, the insurgent Loki, and it's a lot of fun, and written by Peter David, so it's really good stuff throughout. Not as good, though, was the other 2014 Deadpool limited series. The last of the three that I just read was Deadpool versus X-Force. That was four issues. Really good creative team. Dwayne Swarzynski wrote it, and Pepe Larraz did the art with Shane Davis covers. But it is a tale that takes place before Deadpool's first appearance back in New Mutants 98. So it's like him meeting the New Mutants, X-Force, as they were back then, before they even are, before they, it's not, it's like a throwback tale, and it's really shoehorned into continuity, but it's like really modern art, but it's done, like, it's such a throwback story that it doesn't feel like a really good match, and it just didn't feel like anything was going anywhere, because, like, all the pieces had to be put back in place for them to, Deadpool to make his first appearance in New Mutants 98, so that wasn't that satisfying. But the Hawkeye versus Deadpool and the Deadpool's Art of War were both winners. The new one is a sequel to the Night of the Living Deadpool, where Deadpool was inserted into that movie, which was really funny. And now it's a Return of the Living Deadpool, and the first issue already came out, and the next one should be coming out this month in February. So I will report on that once it's completed as well, because you know me, I'm a single issue buyer that reads like a trade waiter.
Cool.
It is, I swear.
That's a lot of Deadpool.
I like this thing of always having a Deadpool limited series going as the second Deadpool book per se. I think it really lets them stretch the character and do the crazy stuff, the Deadpool versus the Marvel Universe, and the him going into the fairy tale, the, you know, the stories, and all that stuff was really entertaining. He is their Looney Tunes character that they can, you know, put anywhere or doing any cartoony kind of a thing. It's fun. I was never a big Deadpool guy back in the day, but I have been turned. I've come around.
More like the reverse.
Well, now that Wolverine's dead, you need someone you can jam into every book.
That's us, Avengers. You just jam them into everything. They take over all the X-Men titles and everything.
It's because everyone's an Avenger now.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I still have issues with. Yeah. Anyhow, speaking of the Avengers, picking up the pieces from Axis. I don't know what everyone's opinion of how Axis turned out, but anyways, Uncanny Avengers is on the rise again.
Cool.
And probably better than the event book.
Nice.
Because you get the whole regular. Well, I don't know if you could say regular. One of the regular, I guess, creative teams from Uncanny Avengers with Remender and then Acuna coming back. And he did the whole Planet X thing, which had all the crazy locales.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't you know, it's in here he's doing Counter-Earth. So I'm like, I love when he does crazy places.
Wait, Counter-Earth still exists?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I'm like, is this a new Counter-Earth? How many Counter-Earths are there at this point?
Didn't Galactus eat Counter-Earth or something?
But it has to do with the high evolutionary, so I'm like, I guess he could just create another Counter-Earth, right?
I'll have to look that up, because now that's like, whatever happened to Counter-Earth? That's a good question.
That's going to come up in Thunderbolts, too. Spoilers!
And I love high evolutionary stuff, so cool.
Yeah. So, like, part of the Uncanny Avengers, well, they have sort of, like, their new lineup. Like, some of the old members, some new members. So, like, a couple of them are, like, on Counter-Earth, and then the other members are, like, trying to get over there. It's just, there's just one thing that really bugs me about this book is the whole direction the Scarlet Witch is going in.
Uh-oh.
It's like the whole Black Cat thing. It's just like, oh, I don't know who my parents are. And I'm like, we're going to go through this again?
Oh, no.
Like,
really?
Like, I'm like, what's the payoff going to be for this? I'm like, I just feels like,
why?
Oh, man.
Why turn her into someone like with like the continuity baggage of like DC's Wonder Girl or Hawkman? You know what I mean? Like, she had an original story, and it was, I thought, very well sort of retcon changed into what it became, but then it's been solid for decades now. You know, the whole thing of her being the daughter of the Whizzer and that whole bit was the, you know, original Roy Thomas explanation, but then having it be Magneto and Magda and the whole high evolutionary connection and Bova, the bovine nursemaid, all that stuff.
Yeah, it kind of inserted perfectly, like right into the guts of the Marvel Universe. So I'm like, what are they going to... I don't know. I'm going to have to wait to see how this plays out, because I enjoy everything out about everything else here, but I'm like, what can they come up with that's going to be better than what was there already?
Hmm.
But anyways, I start wondering about craft and everything else with this book, too, because... You know how characters have certain speech patterns, and then I start wondering, well, Sabretooth sounds a little different here, or has a few extra words in his vocabulary, so then I start wondering about, like, when can you change things like that? I start wondering about writers when they do this, like, if they don't have the voice down, or they're like, oh, well, I should, like, update or modernize something. So I'm like, if your character's been around since the 60s, like, they can't talk... like the 60s now. Well, I guess you could, but...
But isn't that...
You're gonna sound dated or like, weird or something, so...
Yeah, but
I
isn't
always
that...
wonder, like, as long as you keep, like, the core of their speech patterns intact, I guess as the arrows go on, you can sort of, like, add new words.
Oh, sure.
So they sound modern still.
But the fallout of Axis was that, you know, he's a good guy now, right, Sabretooth?
Yeah.
So his personality has changed, so... When you're not feeling as hostile and aggressive and evil, maybe he's accessing, you know, other centers of his brain and he's got a little better language or his language patterns are changed or... I mean, that's one of the deals with the whole Axis thing was them getting... being able to turn some of their characters into new characters.
Yeah. So
for good or bad.
It's interesting. Because it makes me think of things like that. I'm like, yeah, it could be. Could be that. It's just interesting. It, like, makes me have deep comic thoughts about, like, how things have evolved over the years and how you would do that.
Or you do it in a quick miniseries. Bing! Flip a switch. I finally went back. I had been buying but hadn't read the new Punisher series. Have you guys read any of this? The one that started in 2013, that Nathan Edmondson written one?
I think we covered the first issue, and then I meant to get back to it.
Yeah, I think we just covered the first.
Yeah.
For the most part, it's been drawn by Mitch Gerards, who I think it's his only Marvel work that I'm familiar with, at least, certainly currently. But it's been good.
He cut his teeth on a military book, The Activity, for Image. It was super
cool.
Like, it seemed like a natural fit, like a lot of weapons and army and a more realistic style.
Yeah, that works. It works here for sure. The series is all right. I mean, it took me a while. It took me several issues to kind of catch on to any threads and be interested. Some of these gang Punisher crime stuff, it takes a little bit for me to get invested. But overall, the style of the story is really, really slow burn, too. And it's really, like, triple underline, really decompressed.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a cool angle to it. There's this crack military squad, the Howling Commandos. All right? It's a current crack military squad, the Howling Commandos. And they're sent after the Punisher. And it's like sort of like an ongoing thing that's happening while he's dealing with the stuff that he's dealing with. He keeps eluding them. But it all comes to a head, starts getting really good around issue 10 or so. And it's at issue 15, and they're still dealing with, like, they're finally confronting each other thing. Like I said, it's really decompressed. But their angle is they found the last surviving member of the Punisher's family. It's like it's a lady who's it's her maiden name was Castiglione or whatever Castle's real name is, and she's remarried. She's married and everything, so it's not her name anymore. She's got a family. She's got kids, and the Howling Commandos decide that they're going to kidnap the family to use them as bait to draw the Punisher out. And it's like, man, it's kind of really crossing the line here. We're, like, invading this family's house and literally kidnapping them. And, like, their kids are being totally traumatized and they're just being taped up. And, you know, these are, you know, citizens here and they're doing this to them. But it's one of these ends justifies the means kind of a thing. And the Punisher has to deal with discovering this and figuring out how to address it without looking like he cares. Or that they're meaningful at all to him, because then there is value to the fact that they're holding them. And there's the backdrop of this enormous riot that's going on in the city, and the city's burning, and they're all holed up in a hotel that's been evacuated other than the Howling Commandos and the family that's up there. And the tension is just building, and Castle's got to figure out how he is going to... I won't even give anything away more than just address this situation without, again, tipping his hand that the bait matters to him. And it's intense, and the tension is really building, and the story's really great. It just feels like it's a 3 or 4 issue story that's been going on for like 15 issues. But I'm really curious to see where it ends up, and now I'll be definitely reading it monthly rather than letting it pile up. They got me.
And I remember the first issue being pretty good, so I should get back to it.
Any others?
I got Daredevil.
What's been going on since the Purple Man children?
They had the return of the Stunt Master.
Oh, cool.
And Wade and Somni just know how to tell these sort of short, you know, reliable, fun, sort of Bronze Age, but sort of modern Daredevil stories, because, you know, Matt was offered, like, all this money to write his auto-bio type of thing, so he's sort of, like, trying to do that, and it seems like it's changing him, like, he's releasing all this, like, negativity or getting over depression or whatever, since he's, like, freeing himself, like, writing this thing out, and then he has this whole deal with, like, the Stunt Master, and then he's like, how does he keep on pulling off these stunts? Like, this doesn't seem possible. And then now there's a few tricks and a lot of stuff you don't see coming with, like, this old Stunt Master and the new Stunt Master and, like, reality TV, and it's pretty neat.
Cool. I've been buying them, but I've been behind. I'm right on the beginning of the Purple Man Children stuff, and I have been Can't wait to get back into it.
And I also decided to check out some of the recent Silver Surfer stuff, since I knew something was coming down the pike with Galactus. So I was like, oh, might as well check in. Like, I wasn't too impressed when it first started, but...
Boo.
It's kind of a fun series. Like, I think it's gotten better. Like, it kind of reminded me of, like, Futurama in a way. Like, there's just all these weird aliens and...
Sure.
And it kind of reminds me, like, issue 7 was, like, you know when they redid Amazing Fantasy 15 and Slott had all these, like, really, really compressed stories to tell, and he would tell a story in, like, 3 panels? Well, they, like, Surfer, like, he says, oh, yeah, it's like that time I was, and then, like, it would be, like, maybe a story that didn't need a full issue, so he would just tell, like, this whole adventure in, like, a couple pages. So there's a bunch of those in that issue. I'm like, oh, that's kind of neat. And then I guess I've gotten used to the whole talking to his board and his board kind of having a personality. So there's some like crazy theatrics with his board in issue 8, and then it's like falling over and like ugh, it's sort of like man that was work or something. So there's some funny stuff like that in it, and then they start to go on this adventure with his female companion, and then they kind of get into trouble, and it looks like something's going to be going down with the big G.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah. But I've also been reading some classic New Mutants. Don't know why. Like, it's not like another podcast would be. would be covering that. But I realized with the Nova Roma issues where they introduce Magma and Selene, I'm like, I don't think I really got the whole Nova Roma thing, like, when I was reading back issues or whatever. Like, I'm just kind of like, eh, you know, this is just another place. But the first appearance, I think, really sells it, and now I'm, like, really into that setting. Because it kind of reminds me of the original Star Trek where, like, they would just go visit a planet. This would be the mob planet.
Right.
Or this is like the planet where it was influenced by Earth, but Romans are now the main thing. Like that's just a great locale. I'm like, a lot of fun.
Yep, definitely. Listening to the Great Expectations podcast with Jerry and Sean certainly calls back some new appreciation for some of those stories that at the time I kind of breeze through some of those, waiting for the next thing that I was really looking forward to, you know?
Yeah, I don't even know if that place is still around, or if it's, like, the people have, like, left, or, you know, whatever the case may be.
They go back there several times.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know, whatever happened to Nova Roma?
I don't know, we're going to have to do a segment, whatever happened to? What are they doing now?
All right, I'll leave you with one more quick one, is that there's a new digital Infinite comic out there. It's a one-shot, and it is Avengers Age of Ultron Prelude. And as I have come to notice a pattern that the Infinite comics that are not related to movies seem to be much more enjoyable and have much more solid content to them, and the ones that are more movie-related seem to be a lot of fluff. That isn't always the case, but it seems to be the general snobby judge a book by its cover attitude that I can go into looking at these Infinite comics with. And this one, I mean, the creative team is fine. Will Pilgrim is the writer, and Wellington Alves and Manny Clark provide the art. And it's a one-shot, and it goes into the Loki's scepter and kind of what happens to it after the Avengers movie, and how it ends up getting stolen from S.H.I.E.L.D. and then used by Baron Strucker, and then it sets up and places Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch in Strucker's cells in place for the Age of Ultron movie to start. Nothing that major, but it just kind of takes you from one, transitions from one place, point A to point B.
Yeah, I read the Daredevil one. I know, finally, like, it was like 6 months after you covered the Rogue Warrior thing.
Yeah, that was good, wasn't it? That was the one with the Adaptoid, good. Right?
Yeah, that was kind of fun.
Who would have thought Daredevil would be fighting an Adaptoid?
I know.
I thought it was cool.
I miss when he was the Super Adaptoid.
But he would be able to mop the floor with Daredevil if he was the Super Adaptoid. Even Hawkeye doesn't wear that mask anymore. Why should the Adaptoid? All right, guys, that's a quick rundown of some of the Marvel-related stuff we've been reading right now. And we'll keep reading the books and keep sharing them with you when the time arrives. We'll be back in a few minutes and get into some of that Thunderbolts action. Later.
Hey, this is Derek again. I just want to apologize. I just listened back to my first segment. The microphone sounds horrible. So I just want to point out that comic book noise doesn't usually sound like that, does it? I've never noticed. Anyway, I also want to put a break in between the last segment and the one that's going up. So there you go. The break has been broken.
Welcome back, Marvel Noise listeners. It's me, Andrew the LA Rabbit, for another Marvel's Most Wanted Thunderbolt segment. And as always, we have our trusty crew of Whirlwind X, WWX, Kev.
Hello.
Dialing in from Canada. And obviously, we have the full arsenal as supplied by Super Steve Raker from the bunker.
Can't do a podcast these days without me trying to be involved.
And who would want to, really? For those of you unawares, the Thunderbolt segment, still unnamed as we enter our seemingly 50th year of podcasting about the Thunderbolts, covers Marvel's Most Wanted Thunderbolts comic, and as Kevin correctly pointed out, the 1997 smash hit, which had a series of villains disguised as heroes, who then wanted to become heroes when they were revealed to be villains. Kevin, what's our current lineup?
Okay, the current Thunderbolts lineup. Quick, since I think we have comics to get to. Eric, Atlas, he grows. Melissa, Songbird, she makes things out of sound. Abe, Mac 2, he has a flying suit of armor. Clint, Hawkeye, he's an archer. He's a former Avenger. Charlie, Charcoal, he's Charcoal. Norbert, Techno, he's the Tech Man. Our missing Thunderbolts, Carla, Moonstone, Mist. Our other ex-Thunderbolts, Haley Jolt, dead. Baron Zemo, also dead. That was fast.
That was fast. Thank you very much. And the conceit of the show is this is one of Kevin's favorite titles. I am new to the title, and Steve has fond reminiscences of this particular era with the introduction of Hawkeye. So it's two experienced vets and one newbie walking down the road. We're currently about to jump into issue 42. There are a series of ongoing plot lines, and we'll touch upon them as we get to them rather than have sort of a summary at the beginning trying to structure.
This era of the Thunderbolts is basically shortly after Kurt Busiek, one of the co-creators of the title and the idea of this team of villains trying to reinvent or redeem themselves. Busiek's run has ended and Fabian Nicieza has taken over. So we're kind of in a second generation of kind of moving this team and their stories forward with kind of some fresh ideas, but keeping the excitement and the drama and the cliffhangers coming. So they've been through that initial adventure of being exposed and dropping Zemo, and they've lost some people along the way, like you said, Andrew. And now they are really trying to be established as the heroes that they are trying to be, because they've got Hawkeye as their leader. And he's really trying to do right by them and has pretty much earned all of their trust at this point. And he has ties to his former team, the Avengers. And we're going to get into a nice 3-month, 6-issue crossover with the Avengers right here.
And he's earned so much that he took over Moonstone's corner box on issue 42 a few issues back. But this is a dynamic cover showing Wonder, Wounded by Wonder Man trademark. And it's Wonder Man in his ionic form. For those Bubblegum. Of you who may remember the sort of purpley energy kind of form he went through. And he is smashing apart Charcoal while a aghast Atlas looks on with his hand outstretched. There's a lot of great color and dynamic action. I like this cover a lot. I like when they mix up the color palette a lot more. I've remarked in the past, sometimes they keep it to a few colors, but here we've got, you know, the red, yellow, blue, purple, black from charcoal, the orange explosions.
What's interesting is they're doing so much in the foreground of the cover with the exploding shards of charcoal as Wonder Man's Kirby crackling fist goes right through him, that they've left the background sparse. There's no background, in fact, which usually would, you know, kind of look like a cheat in a panel, especially on a cover. But here it actually works. And remember the whole rule of you can't have the same color behind the logo as last month's issue, so that it'll stand out on the racks from the month previous. So they always alternate whatever cover is kind of at the top of each cover of each issue. And here they go with white, and it works.
Oh, for sure, especially because that cover is so busy. The white, I think, really helps it kind of pop out. I think it worked. Kevin, any comments?
I was just going to say, I always mention Wonder Man as a bubblegum. And we'll get to see Atlas as, I don't know, red bubblegum? I'm not quite sure how to describe it.
And we cut right into Atlas drinking himself at his favorite bar. And our creatives are, as Steve indicated, Nisienza and Bagley are the storytellers. This time we have Al Milgrom as our anchor instead of Hannah's been doing the majority of it. Joe Rosas on colors again. Oscar Gongora from Comicraft on letters. And Bree Vort and Harris as our respective editors. And what happens is this is the bar that Atlas likes to go to in his civilian identity. And the bartender is one of the quote-unquote masters of evil in the current incarnation, Mankiller, in her civilian identity, and they both don't know that they know each other's secret, but in a not so subtle nod, she has Indigo Girls and Lilith Fair buttons on her suspense.
And Xena Warrior Princess, yeah. which had the famous kiss thing in it and all that. So she's literally wearing her preferences on her sleeve.
Yes, you couldn't get less subtle, I guess, in a way, but.
But I'll tell you, if you're an artist and you get a splash page, you know, in your script sent to you, and it's a guy leaning over a bar, you know, that's, you know, in civilian clothing, that's not your comic splash page that really is going to draw you in or really make you feel like you're going to show your artistic chops. This splash page is really awesome. This, I don't know why, but it's one of the best panels, I think, of this era of Bagley that I've seen. He's so totally slumped over. He's got his hand in his head, and like you can totally see the weight that like his chin is like sliding down his hand. His hair is like unkempt and represents that he's kind of bumming. His cheeks are punched up because he's frowning. It's a great panel. There's so much character coming out, especially if you know what a crybaby Atlas has been over the last several issues. Bagley did a fantastic job here. Right on the next page, you get back to the butter faces and the crazy proportions and stuff. But this panel, his wrist, the vessels and tendons in his wrist and everything that are propping up his hand show that he's bearing that weight. It's fantastic. He really did a really good job.
I really liked the glass in his hand. They chose like smaller glasses. And then just something about the juxtaposition of this kind of broken down guy holding this kind of tiny, fragile looking glass in his hand. It was really striking. I didn't know. I was attributing it, I guess, to Milgrom. But you're right. I guess it's Bagley. Because I was just like, I was the same with you, struck by this page. I was like, whoa, I guess Milgrom's really bringing out something.
And it's like the weight of the caption boxes on his back, too. You know, it's really well crafted.
I was struck again that Mankiller looks like Atlas.
Yeah, totally.
It's so
weird.
If they
had revealed that they're brother and sister, I would have been like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But Atlas gives us a clever recap, but it's done in the guise of, you know, he has to tell everything as like a regular civilian metaphor so that he doesn't reveal his identity. But basically he recaps what happened, where they went to track down what happened with the V Battalion. There was the big standoff with them. And for those of you that don't know, the V, Citizen V, was one of the original members. Originally, it was Baron Zemo. And then the real Citizen V came out, and apparently the real Citizen V was a former love interest of Atlas, Dallas Reardon. So that left him conflicted.
Yeah, and that's like, what he gets to share at the bar. He's doing it from the point of view that, like, I love this girl, Dallas Rydrian, or whatever her name is, and I've been jilted, and, you know, first we thought she was the Crimson Cowl when she was unmasked, then she was unmasked as Citizen V, and now I don't know where she is, and oh, woe is me.
And I really like how even Mankiller points out how like mopey he is normally, because we've had a running joke about that. But suddenly, a thwack kroom hits the bar, and we end with him saying, "You?" And on the page turn, it's Citizen V saying, "You." And
all
we
right.
left Citizen V had been involuntarily kidnapped slash rescued by the Crimson Cowl to a mysterious facility, had broken out of that facility, and was presumably tracking down the cowl, and she found her.
Yeah, then we go into the... Throughout this battle with between Citizen V and the Crimson Cowl, we sort of get some of the background on Dallas's history, and then how the whole Crimson Cowl Citizen V reveal went down on issue 25 and all that.
Which is interesting, because now it's Fabian Nicienza explaining how Dallas was revealed to be the Crimson Cowl incorrectly. Was that always Busick's plan? I don't know. You know what I mean? It's interesting, because it was such a point that they had to resolve. How the heck could she have been revealed to be Crimson Cowl when they pulled the cowl off? And now she's also being revealed to be Citizen V. And it's interesting. I wonder if this was Busick's solution, or if Fabian wrote it this way. But it makes sense, the cowl, because the cowl teleports. The Crimson Cowl sent the cowl to teleport Dallas right out of her clothes and right into the cowl. So when they pulled it off, it was her. And, you know, saying she would have got away with it too if it wasn't for your kids and all that stuff.
Yeah, good thing it was a suit that couldn't operate too. Like, you wouldn't want to give away your weapons. Like, oh, I have a crummy suit here with no tech in it, and the Thunderbolts won't be wise.
And as Kevin's pointed out, they've done a few of these where it's like, let's highlight the backstory of X character, and this is Dallas Reardon's turn. I like kind of we're getting, because the other thing is Citizen V had a real attitude that we saw, especially in that annual, the Captain America one. And so it's good to sort of build how she grew to that attitude. The only thing I would have liked would have been some explanation for why the cowl just didn't teleport her into, you know, a pit full of spikes or something.
Right.
Some throwaway line about, I had to bump the cowl off back myself to show I'm the leader. Some reason. Because otherwise it's very James Bond or old comic booky, where she just brought her back to explain her plan, which is not, you know, I mean, it's not a big thing, but I would have liked a throwaway line about why she had to chit-chat with her now.
I do like Fabian's method of, we repeatedly had these long, awesome fight scenes throughout the issues we've covered. And Fabian really likes to break those up with like a lot of character revelations or backstory stuff being revealed kind of in chunks within those battles. He did it with the Zemo, you know, and Scourge battle, and he's doing it again here. And it's cool. It keeps the action and the story going at the same time.
That's how you add content to your stories. Like, some modern comics could probably learn a few things from this type of storytelling.
Well, particularly as Steve, I think you pointed out the last time we spoke, both of us really like the multi-panel fight approach, because not only does it show more of the fighting and the counters, but as you say, you can insert other stuff and it doesn't really feel like a flow. If you did this with a series of, you know, three-panel pages and splashes and everything, they may be more impressive pieces, but they don't allow that sort of flexible storytelling.
The conclusion of this little sequence here, it's like the cowl is like, well, I'm going to use my old tricks on you. And then Dallas, as a Citizen V, is like, yeah, you don't think I was that was going to work a second time. So she uses this little electricity trick on her cowl outfit to short out all her tricks.
I love Mikal's picture too. She's like steaming because her cowl's been turned off, and all of a sudden her more evil looking glowing eyes are like just round dots, like uh-oh.
Yeah, no one expects electromagnetic pulse.
Well, so she has
Spanish Inquisition.
You don't really realize it in a lot of the shots, but she only wears like this kind of crazy corset underneath the cloak, so it does create a kind of striking figure, we'll put it that way. But I'm like, so I guess Citizen V had the EMP. You know, makes you think she probably should have used it in the last time they fought, because I don't think she cooked that up there. But it was a nice turn, because Cal was like, I got you, you know, this will play out easy.
How about against the whole V battalion last issue? Oh, never mind, just keep going.
But that jumps right to the crackoom of a bar being thrown.
Wonder Man being evil again.
Ooh. And it's a nice wonder. In the ionic form, he still retains his W across the chest.
Yeah. Typical Wonder Man. Jeez.
Yep. Keep the branding going.
And
he wants his agent to recognize him.
Well, he is in Hollywood, isn't he?
Absolutely.
And Man Killer reveals that she knows, hey, you know, I know you got to stop him from destroying the bar. Atlas is like, whoa, what? But he moves in his own good time and gets big and is like, Wonder Man, what's going on? Like, you know, Thunderbolts and Avengers are all cool. We're buds now. Wonder Man lays this devastating left on him.
Yeah, Wonder Man's not very talkative either.
Oh my gosh, the anatomy on Atlas's arms is so horrible. Like, in every panel, it's like, oh.
It's because he's ionic.
Yeah, but it's like, a bicep isn't that hard of a shape to, like, know how a bicep muscle moves. But at any rate, you still get the power behind the blows being struck back and forth.
But yeah. I just always love how the W is almost always, you know, easily identifiable.
Yeah.
Amongst the jumble of his electron. And, you know, red and purple, good color choices. But Atlas goes to the Man Killer and says, I'm going to need your help. And she's like, whoa, what? Because she didn't know that he knew. And then he's like, yeah, I wasn't going to rat you out. But, you know, I want you to give you a chance. You can become a Thunderbolt. And then we cut right back to, well, they've done this a lot, too, where the dialogue plays against itself. So it ends with, what are you going to do? And then it cuts to our next scene with Ogre saying nothing. Yeah. And Ogre is secretly Techno. He's at this base. And they're trying to track down what happened to Moonstone, who went crazy in the last issue and blasted off. And so they're trying to look at the equipment there, and Hawkeye is really miffed off about it. But also...
Wait, is that Hawkeye or is that Atlas?
Whoa, his hair color changes there.
And his arms pumped up huge.
Yeah.
Hawkeye is drawn like he is got... guns like Atlas practically, and Joe Rosas, seeing that body form, thought it was Atlas and colored his hair orange. He gets it right in the next panel though.
But also hiding out in the base is Scourge, who we saw do in Baron Zemo. We're unsure of Scourge's identity. There's been some suggestion that it could be Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier. But he has discovered the Ogre's hidden lab. And in that hidden lab, there are tubes that have human forms. And one of them is almost pure bioelectric energy. A lady-shaped form.
Hmm.
Young lady, it looks like, too.
But he also discovers that if he kills Ogre, that whatever's cooking in these tubes is going to die. And one of them also looks suspiciously like a short, older gentleman with a... long hair and a big beard.
Well, we know he put Ogre in there. Yeah. That's the only guy we know of who was in the three. There was already a body in there when he put Ogre in. And now we're up to a third body. Right after Jolt died, all of a sudden there was a slender female form with the same haircut who made completely of energy in a tube. So,
I don't know what to conclude of that.
No. I'm just trying to give the timeline. I'm not suggesting anything.
And there was all those energy characters on all his screens, like Zax and everything, which is kind of weird.
Everyone's studying energy. And this Scourge, again, is this, like, helmeted, crazy amount of weapon arsenal. He's got like these luminescent red eyes, and his mouth is a really cool effect. It makes it look like he's got a whole bunch of sharp teeth, but it's not. He's got regular old teeth, but you can see the roots of them all. So the sharpness is like where the teeth would go up into the gum, you know, like when you're looking at an actual skull and not, it's very cool appearance.
And he also has a, like a command structure and support staff. We haven't seen them, nor do we know who they are, but he's not working on his own.
Yeah, this is a very technological Scourge for sure. He's got constant computer logs that he's taking and observations that he's making and stuff for some kind of report.
Yeah, he's always talking about mission objectives and these issues because he's like, oh, well, I was supposed to do this. What about that? I'm going to have to consult with the bosses. And Ogre has some other stuff set up here, and he's like, oh, yeah, I was sort of watching the police dispatches, and I have them set up for things like, look out, Red Ronin is coming.
I love Red Ronin.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Well, we had seen that the Atomic Steed had the old radio broadcast locked in, but that draws them to the Atlas Wonder Man battle, which is getting even more ferumph and spoomph in energy and force lines.
There's obviously something more with Wonder Man because they're tearing down a total civilian area, just doing a bunch of collateral damage.
And Atlas calls him out on that.
And then you get the whole...
Therefore alerting the reader. Well, Atlas is making this plea to Wilma, to the man-killer, saying, help me out here. And she's like, what? Are you kidding me? What, did you think that like we were actually friends? Did you think I was going to be your girlfriend? Did you think I cared anything? Do you think I was doing anything for anybody? What did you think this was? Like it's been every other issue up until this conversation? And she's like, you're a fool. I call myself Mankiller, buddy. What do you think I think of you? Later, dude.
Yeah, we find out her name isn't Wilma.
Yeah, she points out her real name and her real, she's not even American.
Neither is Kevin. I would like the record to show.
This is true.
I thought we
and
were
his name isn't Wilma either.
I thought we were going to keep that dirty secret to ourselves. Carry that to the grave. But in the end, she has a so long, hope you survive. So I think she was stretching it in both directions, She was genuinely probably flirted with going straight once or twice. Straight in the criminal sense, not straight.
All right, does she actually like the Lilith Fair?
That was
or
definitely.
Is that all a lie?
But then I think that she's kind of maybe, she kind of toyed with it a little bit, but then rightly rejected it. Well, also, Atlas is not the best advertisement for anything with his sad sack mopiness.
No, he's not going to make you come over to the other team.
People are being murdered. I'm a sad sack. It's an awesome team.
Look how good this has worked out for me.
Yeah, I've really turned my life around. Wait, no, I haven't.
Hey, he's not getting beat up by Luke Cage anymore.
No, just Wonder Man.
Yep.
And that sends him spiraling down, and then we cut back again to the much a similar battle of the Cowls on the Run being pursued by Citizen V while revealing Citizen V's backstory at the same time.
Citizen V's got a pipe in each hand like Mockingbird with her two, batons. And she's cracking Crimson Cowl in the head. I'm thinking, man, all it would take is one smack with a pipe in the head. Oof.
Yeah, but she has a kind of a sweet headquarters. See, the Crimson Cowl knows how to live. That's all I got to say. Always with these awesome bases and headquarters and, residences. Man.
Well, remember, the Masters of Evil had a first-run movie theater.
That's right.
Who is she?
I don't know.
Well, we might find out more at the end of this, but we get a quick interlude to the high school that Charlie and Joel used to go to, what Charlie still does. And again, another reference to the mysterious 89ers, who are the local bullies, but we haven't figured out what the 89 signifies.
And it looks like one of the classmates has a Distinguished Competitions shirts on here. Kind of a black bat in a yellow circle.
It's funny that it's like the wings are inverted to, so that there's just, it's not a, any
similarities are completely coincidental.
It's Nighthawk.
Yes. The original millionaire vigilante. And basically, there's some overflow from the fight. So Charlie has to go transform and blast off. And Wonder Man's there. And Charlie and Wonder Man, you know, affronts him. And Charlie busts out the old, hey, I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me. And then we get to the climactic battle.
Oh, this is pretty
Crimson
sweet.
Cowl's almost at her jet. And they're fighting on the freeway. And she flips Citizen V over the railing. But V grabs onto her cape. So she's hanging only by her cape. And as a result, the cowl's like, I'm going to let you go. But, you know, you're going to die. But sadly, at least you'll get to see who I was. And Reardon screams, no. Well, we get a shrump. Reardon says no. And then as she falls, she reveals the Crimson Cowl is Eric.
What? No.
Well, I don't know how he could be. Isn't he in that fight in the other scene?
Was he as bodacious in the chest as the Crimson Cowl?
Those have got to be some part of the outfit, is all I'm saying.
No, you know what you got to do? If you're wearing a cowl and it has, and you, or if you're any like superhuman type of guy or gal and you have something that could potentially come off, you wear a mask underneath it. So yes, even yes. If it comes off, they still don't know your secret ID.
Not only that, but you have a ripaway strip between the cowl part and the cape part, because that cape could get caught on stuff. And you want it to tear away. We
saw both in Watchmen and in The Incredibles.
I'm not familiar with those
capes.
Yeah, but the fact that she's holding up Dallas by her neck because she's pulling on the cape and the cape's still attached to her head. And then she's like, all right, I'm just going to let you go. And she sees. So she gets to know who the cowl is, but she falls to her likely death off the bridge into the drink. Plunk.
With her last words. Although it's funny, it says last words, but it really is only one word. Eric. Mm.
Yeah.
Like I said, which leads me to conclude that the Crimson Cowl is Eric. But Charcoal and Wonder Man, Charcoal doesn't really want to fight. So on a page turn, you get Wonder Man literally punching Charcoal to pieces in a very dynamic panel.
Well, he's
just
dead.
Like on the cover.
Just like on the cover. Although, I wish the Rosas normally does a sharp job, but here, I think his Wonder Man is a little too dark. Like, it looks more black on black than the black on purple.
Yeah, it's grayed out.
But it's a pretty page. And again, the no background, it's all yellow and force lines. But we find out that Charcoal can reassemble as Mach 2's on the scene.
Oh, he's like, good.
I'm in pain, but put me on the ground, I can put all my pieces together.
Remember
and
that.
In the interim, Wonder Man grabs Atlas and races off.
Dope.
Well, I guess Hawkeye might have to make a little call to the Avengers, because Wonder Man's supposed to be a hero.
Yeah, and like, why would he want Atlas anyway? Is there, what connects them?
And what clever, sharp-eyed readers will notice is that on the cover, Wonder Man gets a trademark, but the poor Avengers logo in his word balloon doesn't get one. No respect, I tell you.
And the answer to my non-rhetorical question is that the ionic energy is what binds Wonder Man and Atlas. They're connected because they were both empowered with ionic energy. So there's something going on here.
And then in the letters page, as we've discussed last time, someone, I believe Steve, had a similar theory to Ernie Pruckner Jr., who suggested it was the 1950s Cap that could be the Scourge.
No, I thought it was the 50s Bucky. I thought it was what's his face there? Jack Monroe.
Yes.
Not even well, 50s Bucky, right? He's even since then, isn't he?
Yes. And while they do suggest, the same guy also suggests Nomad and a few, but I was just like, whoa, we were all in the same wheelhouse. Because I think, you know, one Brandon Thomas is also like, Scourge really isn't Bucky, is he? That would be too cool for words.
Hey, I wonder if the Ben Herman here who guesses that it might be Jack Monroe from White Plains, New York, is the same Ben Herman I'm friends with on Facebook who posts a lot to, like, the back issue magazine page.
Call him out, definitely, for sure. And as Steve reminds us, there are I believe there is a internet forum which you can interact with Marvel Noise. That's at 11 o'clock comics.
Yep. Indeedly doodly. And there's always Twitter when you want to get a hold of us lunkheads.
Yes, we have individual Twitters and the podcast has a Twitter as well.
There's even a Thunderbolts Tumblr if you can find it now.
There's a several, according to you.
what's our Thunderbolts Tumblr called?
I'm trying to remember because we couldn't get what we wanted.
Thumblerbolt.
So, good luck spelling that, but no, you can find it on the World Wide Web, folks. Everything's there. But
all right.
Issue suggests we go to 32 of Earth's Mightiest Avengers, which has a very sharp cover. My wife commented on it.
Yeah, it's a great cover.
And it's The Secret Life of Madame Mask, and she's holding up the kind of reflective gold mask of that classic villain, and the light shooting off of it creates natural borders, which you have the different Avengers.
I was going to say, this is the Kurt Busiek's writing the Avengers at this time, who was the former writer of the Thunderbolts, so it's a fun crossover to have. Mm.
I just remember in earlier episodes, Andrew used to ask me, so how are you reading these? So I'm reading my Thunderbolts in the issues, but my Avengers in the Avengers Assemble Volume 3 hardcover.
Ah.
And I am started on those trades, but they ran out a long time ago, so I'm floppy in it only.
And that Avengers Assemble Volume 3 oversized hardcover has the Thunderbolts issues in it, too. It has this entire crossover properly sequenced.
Yeah, and the coloring is just slightly different. It's like a little lighter, or it just looks a little different on the paper.
Did you consult with Kevin to make sure the ordering was, in fact, proper?
No, I determined that all on my own.
Oh. He's disputed Marvel's ordering before, I should warn you, Steve.
And it looks like a classic Iron Man on the Avengers 32 cover, too. And if I remember correctly, that's because his old armors were killing him or something like that. His new armors, I mean.
They had the sentience. It wasn't that they had come, they had developed for artificial intelligence or whatever.
No, this is past that, I think.
Oh, this is past that point?
Yeah.
All I can imagine, as we open this up, and as Steve pointed, it's Kirk Busiek, is that they went to Paul Ryan and said, Paul, we got some good news. We found someone to do your layouts. The good/bad news is it's George Perez, so we're going to keep you busy. And then Al Vey on inks and Tom Smith on colors.
Yeah, and this is the tail end of Perez's run, so Paul is just stepping in to help tighten up a couple of the issues. The last issue of this crossover is actually Perez's last on the series.
And I've been enjoying Bagley, and we have a little fun with it or whatever, but let me tell you, when you get dropped into the Perez loveliness, you are really taken back to just top-notch comic booking all the way around. All my trivial complaints have nothing to do with the comic booking. I'm not enamored with the current Wasp outfit, which is a blue number with black accents. Right. I do like the neckline as a W, but it just seems kind of drab for the Wasp. Yeah, she's a fashion designer.
Yeah. Wonder Man's W.
Doesn't she have another outfit like in a few issues and like typical Wasp? Then you're like, that one isn't much better. And she has the arrows pointing at her knees.
So many panels, too, guys.
Yeah.
In these Perez issues.
I love it. I love it. But we have, now this is the reconstituted Vision, who is currently on a break from Wanda. They're separate. Wanda is shacked up with Wonder Man. And we also have a Triathlon.
Triathlon, I believe.
Oh, did I mispronounce it?
Really?
Isn't there an A missing in his name?
All the years of reading it, I never noticed that. If that's the case. Well, I always
triathlon. You're right, Kevin.
Triathlon. You're right.
So, Scarlet Witch is in her gypsy outfit. Iron Man, classic armor. Goliath is in the kind of blue, sort of with snaps and pouches looking, with a little tuft of hair sticking out. Jive.
Yeah, he went back to the old Goliath costume from the late 60s.
And then Triathlon. he does this crazy kind of like tricolor sort of fun outfit.
Like the old 3D man.
Yeah.
Hint, hint, hint.
And this is the Iron Man where you can, he doesn't have anything behind the helmet, so you can kind of look through the eye slits a little bit. And it busts on them and they're having a meeting with their SHIELD liaisons. And you get to see good old Jasper Sitwell.
Done and Director Carter.
What?
Forget all this Agent Carter stuff. Director Carter.
How do I have no memory of that? Like, that must have not happened for long. Like, I don't know, remember how she got to the role. Like,
I thought she was
anything.
Presumed dead at this time, actually.
I don't know. You almost wonder if it's like a mistake.
No. She was the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yes. This is probably after the whole Nick Fury kid thing and all that.
Well, he must come back pretty fast, Nick Fury, because that's like a blank spot in my memory.
And she looks young and quite fetching. Well, we had the last time I had seen her, I'm trying to remember what old trade paperback I was reading, but it had to do it was the Acts of Vengeance omnibus. And the Avengers had the island.
Wow.
And she was heading up the security there, I believe.
She wasn't dead in that?
Yeah, I thought she was dead at that time.
Yeah, Wayne brought her back.
Because there she looks old. And then what happens is, that's where all the enemies switch enemies.
Yep.
And so they sink Avengers Island. And, you know, they have a whole crew there, and they got to defend it to the end and everything. But anyways, this is a different... That was a different day. But basically, there's a lot of subplots going on in this Avengers. We're not going to cover them all. The only one that's kind of fun is the Vision hits on Miss Marvel right in front of everybody. She's in the Warbird, kind of cool outfit, the black with the lightning bolt. And everyone's all nervous, and Wanda's like, hey, I got Wonder Man. You go with it, girl.
I was going to mention how there's no doors to some of these rooms, so if you want to spy on someone in an Avengers mansion, you just sort of hang around or walk by, and you can hear what everyone says.
They go into Madame Mask's history a little bit, the most important things being the fact that the Avengers have recently come across a ponytailed Madame Mask who actually ended up kind of befriending them some, or at least being, not abrasive, and they kind of did a little team up.
90s?
Kind of going... Yeah. It was the end of that Avengers before with the whole crossing thing and all that business with the Teen Tony and all that garbage. But there is some concern over all of these Madame Masks that have died, and we keep seeing Madame Mask pop up. So what's going on? There's been a dead Madame Mask pulled out of a river like a half a dozen times already. And yet we still see Madame Mask. She's got to be out there somewhere. And Madame Mask had a romantic relationship, however briefly, with Tony Stark, Iron Man, including knowing his secret identity, and with Jasper Sidwell, our S.H.I.E.L.D. liaison, who kind of looks like Jimmy Olsen with glasses on.
That Madame Mask, Iron Man stuff, I remember, I haven't read it in forever, but I remember it being great comic books at the time.
Yeah.
I dug it up like with a spoon. I thought that was pretty intense. Like, really good Iron Man stuff.
Yeah. I've read some of that.
Like, the super rich dude is not always the most empathetic, but that was really heartrending, the star-crossed lovers. But as Steve said, in an effort to clear up continuity, we find the real Madame Mask, who's turned into a paranoid, crazed woman with a whole facility. Basically, she hollowed out in the Nevada desert one of those giant buttes, and it just filled with her base. And she's got robots, and she has clones that she grows. And we find out that the one clone that Steve referenced escaped her programming and has this special sort of empathetic ability. And that clone is trying to convince Madame Mask to not be so paranoid. Like, girl, I know you got problems, but these men, they're good men. And she's like, no, listen, you nut job. I'm out of clones. Like, I got to cook up a new one because they keep getting killed.
Yeah, some of them look pretty grisly here. But she's not wrong. Like, she's paranoid, but people are out to get her.
Yes.
Yeah, she keeps turning up dead in the water, for Pete's sake. And she's, like, turned into, like, Howard Hughes-y here, right? She's, like, holed up in a mountain, and they're suggesting that she hasn't stepped out, in years and years, and she's only had these doubles, making appearances for her. Which is interesting. And again, they remind us of her history that she thought she was, just a wealthy to-do, girl being brought up by her dad. Turns out her dad was like the financier or like the accountant of Count Nefaria, who at that time was a powerless as far as superhuman power, but powerful as far as international crime lord. But he was the head of the Magia, and which is the International Crime Syndicate. So that's the angle that I thought really made those Iron Man stories back in the day. And Tony's big and rich, but, you know, international gangsters and all that sort of a stuff. That's kind of the scale that he, you know, plays on, the scope of his adventures. That fits in real well. But she kind of goes through, you know, being betrayed by man after man. First, the dad she thought was her dad isn't the dad. Then her dad is Count Nefaria, for crying out loud. Then her fiance dumps her. Then she has problems with Agent Sitwell, and she has problems with Tony. So she basically has let herself become paranoid, you know, by then holding herself up and kind of not wanting to give anybody a chance ever again. And that's going to keep coming back throughout this whole storyline, that she just cannot, despite what she sees, despite what's going on, she cannot give anybody the benefit of the doubt that they might be actually being honest to her at any time.
With some justification, as she's laid out.
Yeah.
But what I thought was most odd about this is, and it starts a confrontation, and the Grim Reaper shows up with the whole crew, the Steel Skull, and I'm like, when did the Grim Reaper become... Now, to be perfectly valid, I've never been a huge fan of the Grim Reaper. The helmet design, like the skull and crossbones are fine, but I don't like the wings on the side. I don't know, I just never... he was one I just never warmed up to for whatever reason. So having him be sort of the bad guy with a whole crew of quote-unquote Steel Skulls
seemed... In his own helicarrier.
Yeah, that was so weird. Like, I remember him, like, bothering Wonder Man and Vision, but I'm like, yeah, wow, he's moved up. He's got some henchmen from the Taskmaster, and I'm like, when did this all happen?
And that whole Wonder Man Vision, he's connected with, he's the other brother.
Yeah.
See, he's Wonder Man's brother, and the Vision is also Wonder Man's brother because his mind cerebral patterns were all based on a recording of Simon Williams, who was Wonder Man's brainwaves. So the three of them are kin.
And we get some cool pages of the Avengers taking apart the team. And just when it looks like they've entirely wiped them out, the Vision gets broadsided in the back. And we see Floating Head Madam Mask announcing that you're all against me and sending forth all her robots to destroy everything. And just as that looks bad, on the final page turn, who do we have? Graviton. I mean, Count Nefaria. Sorry.
I thought Nerfutiti shows up here.
I get those two confused all the time.
Yeah, I really, like, I think it's just poor, to have two, both, first of all, they're both similar in kind of attitude with that sort of arrogant. They're also the top power level, the kind of whole Reed Richards hair and the cape and the, like, I really,
beard.
They needed to do something to, one of those need to change their look. That
and they
be
both show up. Often pretty close to each other,
yes.
You know what I mean? Those Avengers issues around 160 or so. It's like you get Nefaria, you got Graviton. Those storylines weren't that far apart.
And we just saw Graviton.
Exactly.
So it kind of now that could be a good story. They should have them face off, and fight each other over who's going to look like the crazy.
Right. No, he's my barber. No, he's my barber.
You'd think a similar battle happened with, like, Sandman and Norman Osborn. That's my hair. You can only do it one way.
But so it ends on that. And so for those of you following at home, it's a fun issue, and it didn't cost me any more, I think, than the Thunderbolts one. But I don't think you need this for the – I mean, it gives you a bunch of backstory, but it really is just the backstory. And then my issue ends with an Ultimate Spider-Man preview. And write up on that, and then the Ultimate X-Men. Which was odd, because as I was reading this, I had just picked up Spider-Gwen, which kind of reminded me of the Ultimate Universe for today.
Aw.
It's my... Spider-Gwen is my Ultimate Universe. You know, a young hero I can relate to. Because who can relate to that old fuddy-duddy Parker with his wheat cakes?
I can only relate to Spider-Man 2099. I don't know. He's being cast in the next Spider-Man movie, right? I'm going to riot if it's not, Spider-Man 2099.
Hey, you had your cartoon.
So. What? No. Yeah, right. The Fox one?
He's had various
appearances. Didn't like that? You didn't like that 2099 cartoon?
It was weird because it's like Counter-Earth and it's Peter Parker, but he's Spider-Man 2099. I don't know. It's hard to make sense of that cartoon, honestly.
Hey, I only got half an episode of my favorite Spider-Man, Spider-Ham. So that was on the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon. We're cutting back to now we got to go back to Thunderbolts, and maybe this crossover is going to start happening.
No.
Maybe.
We got to cover all these subplots on Thunderbolts. So you're always, it seems like you're always cutting something out because Thunderbolts is like, well, we got to keep our story going, but we want to be in the crossover. And Charcoal almost is like reacting to it. Well, maybe I'm reading something like that into it, but it's funny. Like, he's always freaking out. When are we going to find out who the killer Jolt is? And it's like, no, we found something else to do again.
Yep.
But anyways, Thunderbolts 43.
We have Hawkeye again. Bagley must not tire of that pose of Hawkeye firing the arrow near the reader. But it points out that Hawkeye and Black Widow are back together again.
Partners in crime, one more time.
And it's our typical, you know, Nicienza Bagley. This time we have Greg Adams returning. We had seen him not too long ago from our last segment. Joe Rose is again with colors and Comic Crafts Albert D for letters. And this is Black Widow, who we'd seen briefly in the Avengers book.
Apparently she's had a lot of time to kill, though, because it says she took 6 hours to climb the mountain that their headquarters is in and then to find an entrance. Like, she's a spy, but I'm like, no urgency there.
6 hours of climbing, too. That's several pitches of rock. So we're talking pitch of rock is you know, kind of under 160 feet because that's the length of a rope. So for the most part, unless you get a really extra long one. So you got to bring up your rope every 160, 150 feet or so for another pitch. So I mean, that must be like a 700, 800 foot cliff for the amount of time you're talking about.
Wow. Yeah, and then she looks into some of the quarters here, and then you see moonstones, and she's like, "Whose headquarters? Whose place is this? It's devoid of personality. Oh, moonstone." And there's some creepy camera trying to like see what's going on in I don't know, is it
she notices that there's little cameras around the base, and her trying to infiltrate the base, she's being careful of security, right? So all of a sudden she notices, as she's looking at the various Thunderbolts' quarters, that there's like little cameras in there. She's like, I wonder if Hawkeye knows that like his base is bugged. Is that like him doing it or somebody else? And as soon as she squishes one, you see Ogre, who we know is really the Fixer, Techno, underneath. Like, he like, huh? I just got a strange disturbance in the Force. Oh, wait, you wouldn't get that reference, Kevin.
This is true.
I also wonder, the
Scourge lounging in the hallway, you could say the same remark. Like, Black Widow's like, is someone here? And he's like all in chameleon stealth mode.
Her thoughts are given in black text boxes. But I did want to say in that last Avengers, we did have a few thought balloons here and there.
Yeah.
Which brought my heart a warm glow. But this allows her to kind of touch base with the different groups that are talking. And we also get a sweet flashback look of her classic outfit.
Oh!
And then what's in a surreal kind of phase is we cut back to Moonstone, who's wearing her old outfit.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. And it's that sweet Fantastic Four peer headquarters that... Wasn't that the one that expanded?
Yeah, she's casing it out like from across the street, and she's wearing that old Bullet Girl looking costume.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, I actually like that over her Thunderbolts outfit. But at the interim, you know, Hawkeye's kind of falling apart because he needs to find Moonstone. I mean, I'm sort of on Team Charcoal here about he doesn't give two wits about what happened to Jolt. He's like, whatever. She wasn't really a Thunderbolt. But Black Widow, instead of going back to report to the Avengers, drops down at a surprise and says, oh, I'm here to help you out, Hawkeye, you big lug. And Mach 2, who knows her, but she doesn't know him, is glad to see. And then in two panels, she gives us everything we needed to know that happened in the entire issue last time of the Avengers. So that's how you get people. That's how you condense an issue, people. And then she points out that they think that what they're looking for is this ionic energy and people that worked into it, ion experiments, and you know that brings us to Baron Zemo. I mean, the real baghead Zemo.
Yep.
The fur, I'm going to assume it's real fur, you know, the white fox fur and the.
Yeah, he's the one that put the ionic energy into Simon Williams and brought him back from the dead and made him into Wonder Man. And then it was the Enchantress who used that same technique to bestow Eric Joston with ionic energy. I think Bagley and Adams, I should say, have a lot of fun with Black Widow's costume in this issue. I really like the way they make it like pull around her knees and stuff. They make it look like it is like almost like patent leather. Instead of, you know what I mean? Instead of just skin tight, like you can see it like pulling and stretching. It's pretty neat. Sometimes it's, accentuates her feminine characteristics. And other times it just looks like they're playing around with just the way that the material curves around her joints. And it's cool.
You know what I like is when she showed up earlier in the title and she was like, I know what you Thunderbolts like when she ran into Abe and Melissa. I know what you Thunderbolts are up to. It seems like you're supervillains, and you're doing a whole scam here. And then right here, it's like Ogre and Abe are talking, and then she's like, I think I know what's going on here. There's something suspicious about you. I'm like, oh no, the Black Widow's on to them again.
Yep, nothing gets past the Widow. She's like, the Ogre's awkwardness seems more like it's like covering stuff rather than truly being awkward. It's clever.
But then Hawkeye in these issues, he's not the best actor either. Like, this isn't Abe here. You're seeing right. A black man. It's not Abe. He's for sure in jail.
Right, Abe? I mean, right, Mach 2?
Exactly.
Yeah, he does a real awkward. Yeah, this is, gives his whole sermon. But the other scene I like is he goes to shower. You know, him and Natasha had a relationship. And he's like, oh, it's good for you. Oh, there's something more. Oh, Melissa seems like a good person. And Haga's like, no. And she's like, well, Jolt's a teenager and she's dead. And Mach 2 and Atlas don't seem your type. Well, maybe Atlas. And then, no, don't tell me. And it's, if you fall in love with that Harridan, weren't bad enough. It's obvious where your sympathies now lie. And Hawkeye comes out with his new outfit and his Thunderbolts belt.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty cool. And a great example in this panel, too, of the way that they're playing with her costume, the way it pulls around her knees and stuff. That's cool. You don't see that much.
And then Moonstone is back trying to... sneaks into the Fantastic Four and is doing research. And she gets caught by them in their new outfits, which have the four kind of over the...
Heart,
yes. But both Reed and Sue have pronounced hearts.
Yeah, I mean, Moonstone had this weird fever dream, right, where she had she's feeling some sort of ancient Kree influence on her. And the Kree are the origin of her powers, so that makes sense. The Moonstone was related to the Kree. So she wants to find out more about Kree history, and where do you go if you want to find on Earth or around Earth what's left of the Kree? The Inhumans, they were a Kree experiment, right? So she's up trying to figure out, trying to get a bead on the Inhumans, basically. So that's what she's doing at Four Freedoms Pier.
And then she says, cheese it, I'm out of here. Oh, wait, no, that's the Spider-Man ad.
And then back to another subplot, which is Andrea Sturman, formerly of the Commission on Superhuman Activities. And she's been investigating this weird, all these mysterious deaths. Hawkeye can't be bothered, but at least someone cares.
Is this London, England, though, or is this because they're talking about Alpha Flight? So am I supposed to assume?
I would assume London, Ontario.
Yeah, it doesn't.
You don't think it looks? You don't think the inside of the shop doesn't scream London, Ontario?
Oh,
you think he didn't do enough research?
I've never been to London, Ontario, so I can't really say. But it's just weird with the whole London thing, because I'm like, those are two like major cities, and they both have the same name.
I don't know that London, Ontario is a major city, but we'll concede the point.
If you know anything about Canadian population stats, it's pretty big.
And I don't. But what's interesting is, remember, we think that people were killed with hard air.
Right.
So she naturally goes to a mutant that has the ability to create hard air that also has a touch, has a connection with Roxxon, the evil corporation.
Which is Windshear from Alpha Flight. now is an artisan, a retired artisan.
Yeah, let me tell you, this is not your father's Alpha Flight either. Mm. This guy ain't no...
You remember Windshear?
No.
All right.
When did he come on to the team?
Gosh, I want to say... just ballpark, issue 50, I'll say.
Oof.
Something like that. Like in that, he was in that, maybe that third generation of, you know, with Box and Windshear and those guys.
I remember Box for sure, but
I thought you were going to.
I don't know Windshear.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say like around issue 100 or something.
Yeah, all right, it might be. That's another series that needs revisiting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But well,
we don't know any Canadian Patriots, so we'll have to pass on that one. But he points out that he did work there, but his bullets won't work against people.
Right. As soon as his constructs touch flesh, they become inert.
Well, they can't be bullets then.
And but, the Thunderbolts' whole angle is if all this ionic energy experiments and Zemo connection is going on, we should find that old base of Zemo's where they did all the ionic experiments and had that equipment. And Ogre figures that he can triangulate the, you know, he starts giving him a whole bunch of gobbledygook, but the real thing is he helped build that base when he worked with Zemo. So he knows right where it is, and he's going to take his time steering them there to not reveal his true identity.
There's one more subplot. We have to go to Happy Latveria, where it looks like it's a bright, beautiful place with a kid with a dress on, with a heart on it, and everything, going to get some water. But it looks like Citizen B, Dallas's body, has washed up on the shores.
Face down, by the way, too.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
I was hoping maybe she's alive, but hard to tell here. So what, they don't have faucets in Latveria? No plumbing?
Not in the...
Gotta go to the streams?
I presume Dr. Doom might have plumbing. That's a stretch, but I'm hoping.
That's the other cultural difference. They don't call them faucets in Latveria.
So the Thunderbolts get to
buckets.
Get to the base, and it's all tore up. And they're examining it and trying to find out what happened, and Ogre's doing his own duel, like he's examining for himself and for the team. And they note that stuff has been dismantled. So someone's been, not only has it been a fight, but someone stole a bunch of stuff out of there. We know that Scourge had a team that could have cleaned it out, or someone else, but...
Right, and that was the big battle. That's why everything's ransacked, is that, remember Scourge chasing Zemo through the whole thing, and they broke the table that from the bunker and everything else, you know? So, it's all torn to pieces.
That's the reason why Ogre, like, he doesn't leave his lair, but since he's Techno, he's like, well, like, how did Zemo meet his end or get defeated? And that's why he's really curious about this place. And he's, like, running across all these things he doesn't tell people, like there's, like, footprint residue on the floor and all this stuff.
Gelatinous footprint residue. What's up with that?
I assumed that this cleanup crew would have removed or disposed of all those tubes with the cloned bodies and all that weirdness.
Well, otherwise, they would have definitely remarked. I think that's the point. They say, you know, the pipes were dismantled, so I think we are meant to assume those things were taken.
I like in a nod to the old J.M. DeMatteis and Mike Zeck and John Beattie era of Captain America, we get a whole bunch of Zemo's kind of like mutated humanoids coming and attacking en masse, and Ogre uses his skills to create a device that kind of interrupts their mutation and turns everybody back. I remember when Cap's buddy Arnie Roth got turned into one of those things.
And we get to see Cyclone, which is with Cyclone, his bad French accent.
Has a couple of scientists that he kidnaps, and Mach 2, he can't go after them because they're fighting, but he does throws a spider tracer on there. And then they find, after the ray transforms everyone back, they find the ion generator. And then Mach 2 picks something up on the radio, and that is where the last Avengers comic laid off.
Right. Reminds you to go back there by giving you a nice double-page spread of the action. Get back to Avengers. Remember, they all were about to face off.
All right.
So that gets us back to the Avengers, which is issue 33. Here we have the same Busiek, Perez, Ryan does the finished pencils from 8 to 17, and Alvey does inks, Tom Smith on colors. Richard Starking letters. And it's this kind of closing up on crazy Madame Mask. And then it's a huge battle scene with the Ionic and floating heads and Count Nefaria and steel
Kirby Crackle everywhere.
And Avengers.
And what the deal is that Nefaria, having been imbued with Ionic energy himself, that's the whole deal of how Nefaria gave himself powers, was he souped himself up with a bunch of Ionic energy. And then, if I remember correctly, the whole big thing was he had a big throwdown with Thor, and he eventually, like, kind of overpowered himself. The old, like, you know, you're too charged up with power kind of a thing. So it was, like, kind of a fluke the way that they beat him. But here he is all ionized up, and because of that control of the ionization, he also has complete control over his two new minions, which is the Purple Bubblegum and Pink Bubblegum brothers.
Two different flavors.
And I like the sequence with Goliath just calmly explaining that they have no hope, but they're just going to keep fighting anyways.
Yeah, but then he pulls out, like, this big gun blaster like he's Scourge or something.
Whoa, Kevin with a new theory. But eventually, Nefaria explains his control over any creature with ionic power, but suddenly these giant cannons just pop out, and Madame Mask is like, my beta cannons, we're going to do you in, and just hammers him.
Vom, 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 vom.
And then the smoke clears, and he's just sitting there, going, that it? And I like how she quickly on her feet goes, oh, that was just a warning.
Yeah, I've got all this real stuff that I've been planning for years. I've got all this stuff inside here that, like, don't tempt me to use it.
Well, she does have something. So even though that was probably, she hoped, like, that would be it, she does have one more plan.
And then the...
Yeah, but he wrecks it. He wrecks the whole base on her.
Yeah, the empath is like, you need to trust her. And then she just yells to her most impressive robot, okay, the Nefaria protocols activate immediately.
And then she tries to escape, and it's like, yeah, not so much.
I mean, yeah. In 2 pages, she goes from, I've got, you know, something in my back pocket, enable the Nefaria protocols, to abandon all hands, let's get out of here. So whatever she had wasn't even close for Nefaria, as far as her being able to whip it out and use it in a timely manner.
Well, she's paranoid, too.
Which means she should have had it ready to whip out.
I guess so.
It's not paranoid enough. So.
But someone else might handle it. She doesn't want that.
Kitches Nefaria off balance, and Triathlon grabs Madame Mask and runs away, because he has the speed of 3 people.
He does.
And, as he sends the bubblegum people away, Vision does this trick where he just increases his density from high up and gets dropped like a hammer and goes crump. Saw some Atlas do something similar.
Takes them both out.
Yeah.
It works. Nefaria has to scoop them up and fly off. And what is impressive here is Nefaria carrying Purple Bubblegum Wonder Man over his shoulder and Pink Bubblegum Eric, like, by his waistband. He can fly off carrying all of that weight far too fast to catch, in Iron Man's words. That's pretty impressive.
And in my version, it doesn't even look like he's touching Atlas. Like, I think
he's got a finger slid under his waistband there.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a total loss, because, you know, they do catch the Reaper, who thought he was going to escape.
Well, he just sort of wandered off going, ah, I'm going to narrate my whole escape. This is so awesome. They don't notice me. And then Warbird, or Miss Marvel, or Captain Marvel, gives him a good punch and knocks him out.
He totally would narrate his whole escape, too. That's completely in character.
Well, yeah, some characters have ego or whatever, so, yeah. It's
big
like,
time.
Yeah. Fun comics.
My favorite Grim Reaper appearance was back, was it Mantlo who wrote it? But it was that first Vision Scarlet Witch limited series that Rick Leonardi drew. And there was a great whole, like, Wonder Man Vision Grim Reaper thing done there, and might have been like the second to last issue or something, but it was good.
And Madame Mask back with the Avengers and everything, hoping that she'll sort of spill what her grand scheme was.
And basically the Grim Reaper was like, you're all doomed, and Wasp just gives them a quick little sting. Let's get out of here. So all the Avengers clear out so that Tony and Madam Mask and have a heart-to-heart.
Well, they need some private time.
And then they mention that Tony wiped everyone's mind that knew him. But I love that Madam Mask records her mind every day and has it updated.
What?
And
isn't
how
that
interesting
the same
is
thing?
That?
Isn't that what Tony does in the future? Maybe he got the idea here.
In Matt Fraction's run, right? Tony recorded his whole consciousness and downloaded it, and that was the tapes that everyone were after and all that as he was getting stupider. That was a very interesting storyline, actually.
Yeah.
What I really like is how, I mean, Perez is just a master visual storyteller, right? He can chunk all this stuff in where you can have every... He manages to have all these people on panel talking to each other, and you still get the comedy of the sequence of Wasp zapping... Grim Reaper, not only that once where it takes up a whole panel, but then you see her like walking him out the door, like zapping him out the door, like in the background, while word balloons from what's really happening in that panel even cover her. Like it's like he fits a nice foreground scene and background scene in a tight little panel on a, what, like a 7-panel page or 8-panel page. It's fantastic.
I thought it was very classic Marvel. It reminds me of like the Uncanny X-Men with Byrne, when you have the like, the flashback inside the person's head that's sort of like split all the way down the page.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And then a nice full page where it's kind of their backstory against her, the shadow of her mask, with Tony with his faceplate up. And then he's kind of tight-lipped about it. Because, you know, she's paranoid. And they go into the briefing room, and they're talking to Sitwell, of course, and he's on the big screen, and he has a dumbfounded look on his face when he sees her.
Yeah, and that doesn't help her at all. Like, it could be coincidence. I mean, it makes every sense in the world, she says to herself, that they would be talking to a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent and that it might be Sitwell. But yet, he's the guy that I'm particularly connected with. So, like, what's this all... Like, there's... In everything that happens, there's like room for her paranoia to be fed. And because of that, she continues to stay shut down, and she just won't let herself accept that she's among friends, honestly.
Yeah, or at least people with a common cause.
And it looks...
whatever he's got planned, it ain't going to be good for her.
Yeah, but and then...
And we... they call up the Thunderbolts.
Yeah, you get a message from Warbird, and it looks like Nefaria, to avoid taxes, has... removed his castle from the States and brought it to Canada. What?
Yeah.
It was all that, the healthcare.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then it ends with a sequence of someone crawling out of the rubble. And, well, we're going to see who that is, but I don't think it's a big surprise. You know, maybe the only other person in that complex that anyone talked to.
I hope she has a ponytail, because that's my favorite Madam Mask.
Really?
So, that was, and again... I don't know. I guess you'd want this one. I mean, it didn't cost, like I said, anything extra that I can recall. But it just was interesting that, like, the next issue of Thunderbolts, we finally get to the real crossover. But I did want to say the cover of 33, what probably most impressed me was not only is it just so many great figures composed and looking good, but they do the tread of Triathlon's boots. And they're different, you know, they're like a little pattern and everything. I'm like, that's the kind of nice detail you get.
Yep, he's got the Triune Understanding, who is the, everything's triangular because there's a big backstory of Avengers where there's this organization that's kind of like a cult, and they are making things hard for the Avengers, but acting like they're not being aggressive or hostile towards them, and their top agent is this Triathlon guy who mysteriously has the same color scheme as the old 3D man and powers as the old 3D man, and he sends him to join the Avengers. So they have this whole thing of like not trusting Triathlon maybe, and Triathlon's actually a pretty good guy, but he is imbued with these triangular Triune Understanding type motifs even on, so his footprint makes little Triune Understanding
It was just trademark. One of those nice little touches that...
What I thought was awesome about this cover is Iron Man is the awesome poses Iron Man is in. Like, that's just... It's not heroic. It's not something you'd oppose. You'd think to put the guy in, but it totally works, even though it's crazy. He's just getting punched back and bent over. And Ms. Marvel, a Warbird, is flying down in this arc where she's got her back bent as only like an athletic female can bend their back. It's like cat-like and like overbent. But it's like a girl doing a girl push-up almost off the ground, where like they keep their hips on the ground and they bend back. And an artist could so easily blow it, but with three lines, Perez gets the whole curve of how the skin would fold on the back to make it work. And it's so cool. I mean, her head and heel of her foot are in the exact same vertical plane. She's so bent and twisted. She's like coming down in an arc flying. But it's really cool. It's partially hidden by the logo, but anatomically, it's a very risky pose to try to draft, and he does it so marvelously. It's fantastic.
Yeah, there's no right wasted real estate. I mean, you've got the UPC box and the logo and the corner box, and everything else has stuff in it. But we move on to, can the Thunderbolts and Avengers thwart the power of Nefaria? And Nefaria answers no. He's got his two ionic buddies behind him, and he's got Hawkeye and Cap unconscious in his fists, and Nefaria looks ripped. I mean, like Hulk level ripped.
Yep.
And he's again,
popped up on goofballs.
We've got Adams again returning on inks as we had last time, and otherwise it's the same. And Albert D returning for letters. And the weirdest thing is the gatefold cover, which is just ads. Not thrilled with that. But the opening splash, they always put good work on it. It's Melissa and Abe, who seem to have come closer from all their earlier struggles, and they're kind of being they're like sort of gossiping in the corner because they're in the Avengers boardroom. You find out when you turn the corner, turn the page.
Yeah, I like how the government liaison here wasn't as impressed with the Avengers bringing the Thunderbolts into the mansion here to discuss strategy.
The war room,
and Wasp has a new outfit as well.
Yeah. It's also weird that one of these, it seems like a scene we would have saw where they tracked down Cyclone and everything is like cut. It's just like, oh yeah, we already did that. I don't know, it seems kind of strange. But they get a scientist out of it anyways.
Yes, and it's the it's one of the ones we saw him abscond with in the previous issue. And
Dr. This is Malice.
Where Hawkeye has this whole speech about, this is our new member, Matt Davis, and he's nothing to do with original Jenkins and blah, blah.
Yeah.
And even Mach 2 was like, oh, please, brother. But they're all lining up for the big battle. This guy, he basically confirms that if you get touch with ionic energy as part of you, he can control you with a touch. And that doesn't sound good at all. And they think he's going to, put the whammies on the world.
That's why they have to call up Cap and She-Hulk.
And yep. Cap gives him a hard time about his new belt buckle.
Let me see some Moonstone action.
And you may have forgotten, Hawkeye mentions she's on a leave of absence. And what that means is she's fighting Reed and Sue.
And it was great in a panel here of her fighting Reed and Sue because she was looking for information on the Kree. The video screens have various Kree related personnel on them, one of them being the old Ms. Marvel, and knowing that Moonstone eventually takes that Ms. Marvel costume as her own, I thought that was a pretty funny coincidental foreshadowing as well.
But I guess they didn't update it on the latest Inhumans information, as we'll see.
Yeah.
But she basically screams a Kree oath as she leaves, and that's what Reed is like. I think she was here just to, go look at my lending library. And this has much more to do with the origin of Moonstone's powers.
Well, at least
ominous. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, at least Reed gives some people a second chance. So that's good. Then we typical Thunderbolts fashion, we go back to that, hey, do you remember that one-page subplot from the other issue?
It's the Roxxon, Hard Air, all that kind of stuff.
I'm writing my book, and we're trying to figure things out.
Yeah, they touch upon mentioning Jack Monroe Nomad here, which is interesting because he's the guy that they keep suggesting the reader come to the conclusion that that's who Scourge might be. But those two storylines, as far as we know, are completely unrelated.
They're also
interesting.
She's in talking to him in D.C., and he is purportedly hanging out in the base in Colorado, but maybe, you know, I'm not going to rule it out. And he notes that, you know, there's no connection except there was a file that was deleted and due with a grant. And the grant originated at the Commission on Superhuman Activities. That doesn't sound good. And then we cut to the next page, and it's Madame Mask building an ionic lock.
Oh, that's this is her plan. Protocols. Finally.
Yep. The protocols have been enacted, and Carl Malleus is ready to shave off an additional 5 years off his sentence for his help. He's all psyched. Woohoo!
He has a Dr. Octopus haircut, too.
That's how you know they're bad scientists.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a page or two of them kind of bonding, the Avengers and Thunderbolts. Ugh,
I kind of cringed at that one, the two-panel bonding of Triathlon and Charcoal. Like, they're like, let's go hang out by the Black Avengers poster since we're the two black guys in the comic right now. And it just seemed to be a little heavy-handed. Like, let's go stand over here because we can relate kind of a thing. Like, yeah. Come on, you guys. And then they look at each other and they're like, oh, we're both black and we both have upside-down triangles on our chest. And they start talking about the man. And I don't know. It just seemed a little overly spoon-fed. Unnecessary,
but... was taking a swipe at him with that crack.
Yeah, I kind of wondered. Like, but he dresses me. He gives me stuff, so he can't be all bad, but...
And then Kevin's favorite Cheez-It ad.
Cheez-It!
It's red. Makes me sad. What a great use of real estate that is. But we flash back to the, ogres at the base, and suddenly he gets taken surprise by Scourge.
Yeah, Scourge decides, you know what? This could... You might be tied to the life support systems of whoever's in these tubes, but that's all right. It's collateral damage.
Yeah, my boss says that those are acceptable losses.
Yeah, so we can finally do battle, but not this month. And then we get to see Moonstone trying to hunt down the Inhumans on the moon, and while she's smashing things up, she wheels her costume to go away, and she's walking around naked, it looks like, again.
Dope.
I thought she was wearing her old costume.
Oh yeah, hard to say.
Yeah, it's.
She's kind of.
They didn't change her. They didn't change her face tone. So yeah, probably. But what she's doing is she's looking for Adelan, right? Reed helped Black Bolt move it to the moon back in the FF, and it's been on the moon for a really long time, and it's not there. Why isn't it there? Well, it's not there because didn't it get moved to like Atlantis? And when Atlantis rose, that whole thing
didn't
that
it
was
also
very
move?
Short-lived.
Didn't they like attack the Kree or something in the early 2000s as well? Like,
well, yeah, that was later. That was later.
But that was
that they flew off after the Kree. That was like DNA era stuff. Wasn't
no,
it?
There was a mini series before that by
Ladron, maybe. Yeah.
There was some weird stuff before the modern era because this is sort of the maximum security era.
Yep.
Yes, there's lots of ads for that in the midst of the book. But as Kevin pointed out, Nefaria relocated to Canada, where all super criminals go. And the Avengers are going to try and do a 1-2.
Are welcomed, you mean?
They're going to have one group try and draw them out while the other one sneak in, you know, to use the ionic lock.
Well, seems like a good plan. And, you know, if you can get rid of his minions, maybe you can take him down.
Yep, She-Hulk throws a couple of minivan-sized boulders against his wall to kind of knock on the door, and sure enough, out come the Bubblegum Brothers, and it's on.
And Iron Man nearly drops the weapon to destroy it.
Of course.
Well, that's because he's in his old armor, right? If he was in his new armor, he wouldn't have to worry about stuff like that.
Yeah, he would just have it plugged into his armor.
It'd be into part his of the chest. Circuitry.
Yeah.
And the B-team crawls through the sewers and busts into the castle.
And then we get a bullpen Boltons of, like, the movie Magneto. And it looks like Professor X, but he's wearing, like, a Captain Picard outfit. And then Wolverine goes to, movie Wolverine goes to play poker with, like, movie Sabretooth, Darth Maul, or is that the Toad? And Mystique, which is kind of strange.
Now, on this raid, when the A-team comes in, who's got the ion destabilizer or controller or whatever it is, they, because they're parrying with the henchmen, the ionic henchmen there, Iron Man blasts them. And, or is it Iron Man who shoots them? Yes. Oh, no, it's Mach 2 gets the weapon, he blasts the guys. And so they are restored, but unconscious, but no longer under Nefaria's control. Oh, yeah, Nefaria, where's he?
Building a giant bomb.
I mean a giant bomb. Kevin isn't...
Bomb? Like a soothing cream?
No. No, that would be difficult, because how would he rub that on everyone? That might be a multi-year plan to set up a company, sell this bomb, and then get everyone to apply it to their skin. No, he's going to go after a bomb that releases ionic energy all over the world.
Uh-oh. And he controls anything that's ionic energized, right? So that can't be good for everyone.
And it is this weird giant globe with, like, weird...
God, I get like a Ditko energy. Vibe.
Yeah, the Ditko kind of lines.
It looks kind of like I get a Doctor Strange's Window of the Sanctum Sanctorum vibe from it, like with the way that like Clea's fishnets were all weird, like, you know what I mean? It's like scaly, almost stained glass looking. It's a weird looking thing, but it's a thing, that's for sure.
Do you think they took any inspiration from the Mad Bomb?
How could they not? I'm inspired by the Mad Bomb every time you mention it.
And they fire the ionic lock, and the final splash is nothing happens. And Ferry's like, you're all doomed. I'm going to wash the Earth in ionic radiation and be the master of everything. And then it's just like lightning behind him and weird shapes and everything. This is like the Ditko background.
We did the Thunderbolts issues. Yeah. We're done, right, guys?
We're done? Double-sized finale.
Oh, wait, we have one more Avengers issue.
And it's a double-sized finale.
Yeah, it doesn't say that in this hardcover, though, because they stripped out all the logos and extra stuff, so you can just look at the artwork.
Wait, it doesn't have the 2000 Wizard Fan Award winner box on it?
Sadly, no.
Best moment of the 2000 was Avengers confronting Ultron.
They were the best series and the best artist, George Perez.
Hard to argue with that around that year.
Yeah, and it's Nefaria in like a green wash. Which seems, I don't know why green. Because so far we've had red and purple, but maybe they want another one. And it's...
new flavor.
Busick Perez Alveon Inks / finishes with Tom Smith colors and Comicraft's Albert Duchesne letters.
And the Thunderbolts going along for the ride.
And you get them piling on with a quick little recap, and then the opening double-page spread is just every figure blown apart with Nefaria in the middle.
Yeah, I guess they're in the sky or something. I don't know. You wouldn't really want to draw a background into that anyways, but, you know.
No, it would just clutter everything. Yeah. You can't. So it's just classic Perez doing a million different figures and rubble all amongst them. And then he goes back to the next page and super detailed backgrounds, Kevin, for you. You just get lost looking at those, the trees and the shrubs and the stones on the castle and all that stuff.
And they're all on the edge of a cliff, so there's a silhouette page of Nefaria doing, like, the Vision make himself dense and drop move, but he does it to cut the edge of the cliff off, basically cutting probably about, like, 15 yards off of the edge of the cliff with all of the Avengers on it. So they go falling. And of course, Perez is back in his full glory here. So you get them falling through the sky with tons of rubble and everything like that, and trees and rocks, and Perez in all his glory.
And people in crazy positions and looking good. Yeah, the only thing that's weird is like, okay, so they're like flyers help the non-flyers. And it's like someone else, catch someone else. For some reason, Mach 2 goes to catch Charcoal, who says he can survive a landslide, and he can also fly.
Yeah, so, that's true. That is so true.
That one had me. And it's one thing if it was an Avenger, but his own teammate. Like, I know people don't pay a lot of attention to Charlie, but maybe they should at least have a rough idea.
And I would think that Cap on Mach 2's metal back would be getting pretty hot if the lava hot charcoal is also holding on to. Like, metal's a pretty good conductor of heat, is it not?
Well, maybe he should put his shield underneath him and then it'll be okay.
That would work. He should have ridden the shield down.
Yeah. But Nefaria is just putting everyone on the defensive here. So the Avengers, they get a few, punches in or whatever, but not... they can't really mount much of an offensive because they're coming up on a town here that's going to be squashed.
Like, one move of Nefaria's takes them, all of them, you know, several panels to, like, resolve, right? He goes and he throws a big semi into a crowded parking lot. They got to all scramble and deal with that. And then he starts blasting up gas stations. Like, oh, man, now we got to all deal with that. They're really, like you said, he's one step ahead of them, and he's making them spend a lot of time and resources playing catch-up.
But, you know, the gas prices on this sign are accurate, though, at the time this comic came out.
I'm also like, he puts, like, treads on all the tires in the background. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Like, the detail in this comic.
Yep.
And that's it. These are in, like, small little panels, you know. I'm not talking, like, a double page. Just every panel. And if it's close up on a person, it's got lots of detail. Just, all in all, tremendous work. Like, clearly, he earned his paycheck on this double.
Yeah.
I mean, a double-size issue?
Ooh, you know what I just discovered? I'm reading this on the Marvel Unlimited digital service. And if you turn your tablet on its side, you get two pages side by side, you know, if it's not a double page splash kind of thing going on, double page spread.
Yeah.
But if you go to zoom in on a panel, it only zooms on the one page and it leaves the other page the right size. That is pretty cool. You can zoom in pages that are next to each other to different sizes while they're still touching. That's pretty neat. All right, go on.
Nefaria reveals his whole plan, which will kill millions and poison millions, is he just wants to be respected and the boss. And if anyone gives him trouble, he'll just instantly control them.
And I like how he keeps referring to, he's going to get what's coming to him. That's his goal. I just want what's mine. I just want what's coming to me. And he's being friendly, and he's, you know, even though he's beating the snot out of the Avengers, all along he's been talking to them, you know, pretty respectfully. you know, calls Wasp my dear and that kind of stuff. He's a very polite, smiley guy who's destroying the infrastructure around you.
Well, apparently, if no one would have disrupted his idea of the world, then he would have never became a supervillain or anything. So it's everyone else's fault.
And they try a bunch of different strategies, but everything fails. But we find out that Madame Mask gave them an incomplete ion clock, and she has the real one.
Paranoid.
But what she's going to do is wait for Nefaria to kill all of them, and then she'll be able to attack Nefaria, and then she'll be safe again.
But there's that mysterious shadow creeping up behind her again. That's her. Well, sort of.
Last time it was a shadow, it was Citizen V.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have the, you know, the ears and everything.
But, suddenly there's a rumble. And you know what that means? The bomb is launching.
Oh, don't tell me.
But the Bubblegum Brothers wake up, and now they're free of the control. But they're both still ionized out. And they're like, we got to save this. And they both rocket out of there to go catch the bomb. And then there's a cool, out of all the Hawkeye shooting arrows at the reader, this one has my favorite. And it's just a one little insert where it's just the arrowhead pointing kind of almost straight, not quite straight at you, but almost straight at you.
Yeah, it's a great shot.
As he shoots a arrow at, you know, because that's really going to stop him.
But it looks like he gets him right in the ear. It's a, you feel it.
It's a Thunderbolts comic, so I'm pretty sure they have a strategy for dealing with people, don't they?
Sure. Do Maneuver 24. Do Maneuver 89. The 89ers.
Because, you know, they love the sound construct cage that they put people in. So they try it again, and that doesn't last. And then they get solid sound shrapnel when he blows it up. So the Vision tries the ultimate in pain. He tries to do the where he phases through him. Like, you know, that's always meant to be the most painful thing.
It's always painful to him. He always feels feedback because it's like you can't have him do the ultimate move all the time and just defeat the bad guy all the time.
Right.
So he's always like, no. Or something.
Should have called Kitty Pride in to help. But because he hurt him, the rest of them are like, we got to pour it on. And then we cut over to Madame Mask, who's like, oh my gosh, they actually aren't being slaughtered. And then looks like Kevin was right because our Top Knot buddy shows up. And it's the dupe that has the Psy kind of like empathy powers.
Yeah.
And he's like, and, you need to help.
Yeah, I mean, M-Mask is still all, oh, I don't know how this is going to go. This could all still be rigged. Like, after all this time, I don't know, maybe they're just really good actors.
See, so, now I'm starting to think she's just narcissistic, because now it becomes that this is all a show for my benefit, right? Like, I'm so important that they're staging this entire thing to pull one over on me.
Well, if Nefaria has problems, she obviously has issues as well. Right. But yeah, her duplicate takes up the whole handy-dandy weapon that's all intensified now, but she doesn't get a chance to use it because Nefaria just totally wipes her out and murders her, I guess.
How often do we tire of the person making the speech before they give the final shot? I thought that was a nice... Like, she's like, get out of the way, I'm going to take care of it, and then, blam.
We were disintegrated before she even finishes her final syllable.
So finally, this calls Madame Mask to action.
About time.
And Nefaria's like, huh, two of them, but it's too late, because sham.
That's all the distraction they needed for her to fire it off. And I think there should have been a well-placed hex bolt at the same time, personally.
Mm-hmm.
But
didn't work. Guys?
Just to make sure.
Guys, the intensifier didn't seem to have worked. He's still there. That tickled. What else you got? And everyone's like, oh, no.
That's why I'm saying the hex bolt, right?
Yeah.
When she fired the hex bolt before, that alone almost knocked his socks off, right? So if she would have combined that with this, that would have been it.
But wait, it looks like he's bleeding green out of one finger.
Oh, that's good. That's a good sign.
Goliath is checking his chart, and he's like, he's losing energy.
Oh, I thought he was taking a picture of himself.
In a selfie?
Yeah.
No, he's looking at his pocket calculator.
Yeah, so it's pile-on time for the Avengers and Thunderbolts.
Good. I don't like Bavaria. And meanwhile, we get the Bubblegum Twins heading out into space.
Because it looks like that whole bomb has made itself into orbit.
Wonder Man points out that the last time this happened, he didn't do well.
Yeah, didn't
the
he
big
die
in... N-bomb, right?
What wasn't it? Didn't he die in Forceworks number one or something?
No, before that. It was... Oh, wasn't it? That was when he came back, wasn't it?
Oh.
It was...
Maybe
didn't he die when the bomb went off at the end of Operation Galactic Storm?
Yeah, maybe
it
was.
Did he die in the big Negabomb explosion? I think. Could be wrong.
But I don't know, because didn't Wanda bring him back in this Avengers series, issue 3?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so...
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, we got this already. Maybe.
Nefaria's had enough. He's now gotten mad and dumps the whole water tower on him.
Ah, the old water tower trick.
And then it's a really nice couple of pages of them being kind of swirled around. And when we next see Nefaria's eyes and mouth are green. And he's like, you know, he's now mad. He's past his little polite banter.
Yeah, it looks like the Scarlet Witch takes off her cape at this point, which is probably a good idea when you've just been drowned in the water.
Yeah, soggy.
Yeah.
But, you know, he makes their hair look soggy, and he really does all the details, you know?
When your cape's wet, it's like Dallas Roydrian is, like, hanging off a bridge from it.
And meanwhile, the Bubblegum Brothers, they have one... Simon Williams can't fix it. His engineering degree is too old. It's like, this wasn't programmed in Fortran. I don't know how to do it. He's like, you got one chance. Maybe one chance. And then below, they all go no as the bomb explodes.
But it doesn't expand. They stop it. So Atlas actually does something. He makes up for his sad sack existence.
I'm going to assume it was all Wonder Man. But that makes Nefaria turn green, literally, with anger. And he's like, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to get it. And Glass, like, he's lost control. He's leaking energy faster than in. We don't need to do anything. And he goes up in the sky and blows up.
You get all these great, like, eyeball, close-in, sweating, water.
That's water, not sweat. Although it is a nice Ditko tribute.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 15 pairs of eyeballs. You just see the bridge of their nose and their eyes, and you can go through and try to guess, who's that, who's that, who's that? And it's funny because the Wasp's whole face is in it because she's small. So even given the same panel space because she's a smaller character, more of her face would fit in it. That's cute.
And the Vision is the one that looks freaky, the red eyes and the red face, because there's no pupils or anything. He does look weird.
And Goliath, like, all you see is, like, the space in between his eyes because he's so big and just the top and a bridge of his nose.
They should destroy him. It's not safe to have a robot like that around. I predict nothing but bad news.
What?
And then Iron Man dials up his telescopic viewports and sees that Wonder Man and Atlas are falling to the Earth.
Oh, they don't look well, though. They have a little bit of a case of the greens.
But while he goes up to catch them, Madam Mask decides to walk off into the shadows, seemingly forever.
No, she has to join the Thunderbolts, doesn't she?
Hey, listen, she doesn't want to be a criminal, but she's wanted by the law, wanted with cause, and can't live in the straight world. And then there's the sound of jets and of rustling, and Mach 2, baby.
You're not going anywhere, baby.
And Mach 2 is like, hey, you saved the world. I ain't got no beef with that. But, you know, if you need to talk, here's a special chip that you can plug into a phone and it calls our base. We have a psychiatrist on the team.
When she's not running off in a ancient Kree fever dream.
Yeah, who's currently crazier than anyone else on the entire team.
Yeah, then Hawkeye's like, hey, you could help us out with Jolt's murder. But what I really want to know is, where's Moonstone?
And then we go back and they're not doing good. How are they, Hank? Not good, I'm afraid. And then they're like, we need medvac, quick. Wasp yells into her credit card.
they had to have one last connection to closure to the whole, Jasper Sitwell knew Madam Mask and had his brief romantic affair with Whitney Frost. So you at least get to see him showing some concern as to what the fate of Whitney Frost was, and he's like, oh, yeah, that's right. She's gone. Whoops.
Notice he came out a lot better in that exchange than she did, if memory serves correctly.
You know, I got one of these Avengers credit cards, I think maybe in a Wizard magazine or something.
And I have it,
all
too.
All the stuff on there, and I was like, yes, I'm a member of the Avengers now.
You and me both, buddy. It's hanging right up here in the bunker. I even see it.
You also have the
reform criminals.
There's also the graduation a diploma from the X-Mansion, too.
Nice.
Well, as long as your employer accepts it, Kevin, that's what's important.
Oh, yeah.
And that brings us to the third Avengers Thunderbolts crossover. There was even a quick brief nod, I think, a little bit, to the when they mentioned the liaison that was from the novel. I don't know if you noticed that in that first one. I don't know if you've gotten to it, Kevin, but...
No.
They have a kind of a throwaway line that I was like, hey, wait! I remember that. So I thought this was a lot of fun. I'm not super from. I think I read one of those out of the library, one of those Avengers collections. But I think it was earlier than that because I think Perez was the whole thing.
Yeah, those were great.
But that would have been years ago. So this is my first experience with it. I think it's fun, boys.
A lot of action. A lot of action. A lot of just kept it moving, right? It's just a roller coaster ride, these books.
It was
hey,
good.
Hey, Kevin, I've got a Imperial Guard Shi'ar membership card, too.
What?
Yeah, I swear to God.
Wow.
It's yellow, and it says, like, the Magistrix Lalandra drafts you to the Imperial Guard.
Ooh, is that still valid, though, with Gladiator running the
name?
Show?
Oh, he's got to accept it. Actually, I don't want to be a part of his guard. How about that?
I thought maybe you're grandfathered in.
So what did the 1979 Kevin or think of?
You know, I forgot to check in on him because we had so much to do.
Ah. Well, I can only imagine that you loved these issues because how could you have not have? Perez was involved. Kurt Busiek was back handling the characters. Another crossover. All the subplots kept, you know, weren't put on hold. They kept on going along.
There's a couple of things I remember. I know I loved it more back then than I did now. Like, I'm not saying that I didn't think this was good. It's just I was so immersed in Marvel stuff and Thunderbolts and Avengers, reading the monthly back then, like, I was just like, yeah. And the other thing, I remember that when I mentioned the whole, oh, they cut that whole battle out with Cyclone, I'm sure that's something 2000 Kevin would have picked up on, too. Like, oh, that's kind of a weird cut, but, you know, you need to get that Crimson Cowl and Citizen V and Latveria and all that stuff in there, so it's acceptable.
And it really was the end of that run of a great series of arcs for that Heroes Reborn Avengers. I mean, that was the end of Prez's return, you know, to the team and to Marvel, for that matter. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Prez was connected with the Avengers back in the 70s, and then he came back to pull them out of the Heroes Reborn, or, you know, all that mess, and it back into Heroes Return, back into the Marvel Universe. Busick, Perez, boom. And they gave us 30-something issues, give or take a couple of fill-ins, and this was the conclusion of it. And it was neat that it was all tied in with the Thunderbolts and everything, and we got to re-experience it.
Yeah, well, they had so many double-sized issues, so that's... I'd imagine you would need some fill-ins and everything at that point. And I guess you also had... a lot of other Avengers craziness, which we're going to have to touch on because of Avengers Forever and stuff like that coming up.
Well, that'll be a little taste for tomorrow, but tomorrow in the metaphoricals, that's not literally tomorrow. We won't have two episodes back to back, but thanks, loyal listeners, for stopping in for our Thunderbolt segment. We'll come up with some clever name for this thing at some point, but in the meantime, keep making mine Marvel noise. Boys?
Later.